Meeting will come to order. Representative Smith moves his bill 3572. Representative Smith, go ahead and present your bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a state fire marshal with me who I'm going to ask to walk through the bill, but what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is it is a repeal of some statutory requirements for furniture flammability, which are also contained in the Minnesota State Fire Code.
Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal.
Jerry Rosendahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In 1990, the legislature passed the Furniture Fire Safety Act to address furniture flammability in public occupancies. At that time, the State Fire Code did not address this flammability in furniture. Since that time, the industry standards have improved in this area, as well as the fact that the State Fire Code currently covers this area. Therefore, this section of statute is no longer necessary, so we urge you to repeal the statute.
Thank you. I'm missing something. Did you take over for, I thought his name was Brace or something like, Tom Brace or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, about 5 years ago I took over.
Oh, that okay. Okay. thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Smith or Mr. Rosenthal? Okay. All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. That went to the general register, yes. Representative Hillstrom moves her bill 3146.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment. I gave it to the pages as I walked in. Mr. Chair, would you like me to describe the bill and the amendment?
Well,
just
I thought that we'd have you describe the whole thing together. It's just about out, I believe. Okay, I think it's out now. Representative Hillstrom, you have the A1 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Social Security bill. There is a law that is due to go into effect July 1st, which, according to the business industry, will bring commerce to a stop in the state of Minnesota. And so I worked on the Social Security bill last year, which did not correct their problem, but was a consumer protection bill. And given the fact that I had worked for more than a year on attempting to get compromise on that issue, I became the elected person to carry the bill to fix the problem. So I have been working with groups of lobbyists who attempt to deal with the issue. Representative Holberg was the original author of the statute, so I've been checking in with her on a regular basis. Members, what this does is Social Security numbers, July 1st, it will be prohibited from the sale of Social Security numbers, period, in the state of Minnesota. And the industry has a concern because your Social Security number is on your mortgage, so if they secondarily sell your mortgage on the market, the current law that the law that will go into effect July 1st would prohibit them from selling the mortgage from one mortgage person to the next. Any document that contained the Social Security number, the industry has said, would be a problem. The credit reporting agencies have said that after July 1st, a credit report will never be able to be given to the state of Minnesota again based on the language. So this is an attempt to fix those issues. We have, we've had two amendments so far along the process. The language is not perfect, but it's close. We're getting closer and closer all the time as we move on. And so I have committed to working with Representative Holberg and all the people who are interested in this issue, and that's what this bill is, Mr. Chair.
Is there any, first of all, witnesses from the audience on this bill? No one seems to be coming down. Are there any questions of the author? Comments? Okay, looks like. All in favor of Representative Hillstrom's motion to pass and be referred to the General Register?
That's correct. That's
say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Mason. Representative Mason, does somebody want to move her bill?
I'll move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh moves House File 635. Representative Mason, go ahead and present
your. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Would you also move the amendment so that the bill will be in the proper form?
Sorry, representation, what did you say?
Would you also move the amendment?
Is that the 1459?
Exactly.
Okay, Representative Mason moves the 1459 amendment to get it in shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Mason.
Thank you. We've been before this committee with this bill before. As I said earlier, we had told it so we could do some modifications that the industry was concerned with. We've addressed some of those. The main bill, quick and dirty, basically we're dealing with the extension of contracts and making sure that consumers know what it is that they are buying. It's to have clear billing practices. We have deleted the business-to-business section, which was one of the areas that was controversial. We've also modified the third-party portion, and we've removed the font size. And in Commerce, they deleted the remedy portion, so we're also addressing that in this. And from that point, you know, if you have more questions, if you would like me to go into more detail, I can do that, but I know you've heard it before.
Well, we'll see. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is this bill didn't meet deadline in either body, and I'm just wondering what your intent is. Is this informational or?
Well, Representative Holmberg, my understanding is it did meet the deadline in the Senate, and that's what I've been told. And so, in any case, we would be sending it to General Register. That's not for us to determine. That's for somebody higher up than us to determine. So that will be the motion is, my understanding is to send it, isn't it, to the General Register?
Exactly.
Representative Mason? Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, unless the computer was wrong last night, it still shows that the Senate file is in Metzen's committee.
Well, Representative Holbrook, I don't know. We're going to hear it, and the motion is to send it to the General Register, and then they will, if there's something you want to argue with them, that will be fine. But we don't determine those kind of things here, what the Senate does. Is there any other discussion of the bill? Okay, then I guess all in favor of the bill, say the motion by Representative Lesh to pass as amended and send to the General Register. Say
nobody wants to testify on this bill.
Is there somebody from the general audience that wants to testify in this? Is there somebody opposing this bill? Oh, okay. Sorry.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holver?
I've also been informed that this committee isn't in possession of this bill.
Representative Holbrook, I guess we're getting it at session, so we might as well go ahead and hear it, and then we'll vote after session on it.
Do we have any rules? Are there any rules?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Beth Knudsen, and I'm here today on behalf of AT&T.
Could you, I'm sorry, your name?
Yeah, Beth Knudsen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Easy.
We appreciate the time you're giving this issue. I know Representative Mason has worked very hard on this, and some of the amendments that she offered today are in direct response to some of the concerns that have been raised by the industry, and we appreciate that very much. I'd like to talk a little bit about the complaint numbers, because I know last year when this bill came before this committee, those numbers weren't available. And since then, the industry came together and had a third party aggregate our complaint data and take a look at that. And in 2006, we had 625 complaints. And in 2007, we had 415. And we keep meticulous records of the types of complaints that we receive from AGs all around the country, Better Business Bureau, FCC, all those types of things. We obviously, by our code, we have to respond to those in writing within 30 days. So we do have a very detailed process to keep track of that. And our records show that there's actually been a drop of 210 complaints from 2006 to 2007, which would be about a 34% drop in just raw numbers. But when you look at the fact that we added 321,683 customers that same year, it's actually almost a 40% drop in complaint rates. The AG has offered some of their own numbers. Their numbers indicate an increase from 2006 to 2017. Their number from our number differs by about 150% from their 2007 number. And we've been hoping to get some kind of resolution on what the difference in those numbers is. But just to kind of put it in perspective, if the Metrodome was sold out and the Vikings were playing and the Metrodome is sold out on any given Sunday, there were 64,121 seats in the Metrodome. Only 1.6, according to their numbers, of those in the audience there would have complained to the AG's office in any given month. If you use our numbers, it would be less than one person in that whole stadium would have complained in a month to the AG's office. So we don't feel like we have a problem in this industry that requires a legislative fix. AT&T's own complaint data dropped 51% from 2006 to 2007. So I think what's important is it is a large number. Anytime one customer complains, it's a problem, and we believe the industry is addressing those issues. But what we're seeing both nationally and here in the state of Minnesota is a downward trend. So that's why we're hoping that you'll take that into consideration as you look at some of these complaints proceedings and as you determine what level of enforcement is appropriate for some of these types of complaints that are being raised. Excuse me. I'm going to skip some of this because I think we've addressed a lot of it, but although we don't think the legislation is necessary, we have obviously been working with the AG's office and with Representative Mason and Representative Johnson and his committee to talk about some of those specific things. And what I want to stress is that there's never been an issue of whether or not customers should have the type of information that this bill would require or even what disclosures should be provided. The question, the sticking point has always been how we would provide those, and we believe that the bill is very prescriptive, much more prescriptive than the version of landline disclosures that are required. I'd like to just briefly go through the issues that remain in the bill. And I understand that your prime concern is the penalty portion, but just a very high level. One of the things that we understand the AG's office is not comfortable making a change on is throughout the disclosures, it requires disclosures at the point of sale. At the time of sale is the exact phrase. And as an example, if I were to buy my dad a cell phone and wrap it up, and I at the time that I buy it, I make the decision he's going to be on the senior plan and all those things, and I wrap it up and I give it to him 3 weeks later, and my dad doesn't to this day own a cell phone, so he's maybe a little hesitant as to whether or not he should activate it. On the day that it takes him a week or so to activate it, he reads the book, decides he's going to keep it. He activates it. The activation is what starts our 30-day return policy. And so at what point was the sale made? At what point do those materials need to be given to the customer? And so that's one of the things that we've been trying to work with them on and maybe consider something like the sales activation process so that you know, sometimes if you buy a phone over the internet or if you call our 800 number, the phone and your welcome kit that contains the contractual information arrive at different times because they're shipped from different locations. In Subdivision 4, when we talk about, beginning on line 2.19, we talk about specific acknowledgement from customers on early termination fees and possible changes in the price of their service. This would require substantial changes to our interactive voice response systems and our contracts and those kinds of things. We're talking about millions of dollars throughout the industry. So to do that for a place where, first of all, in 2006, the AG had 91 complaints on this issue out of 3.6 million customers, and to require that kind of investment with a problem that doesn't seem to be growing. The other issue is that all the major carriers last fall announced that early termination fees, they'll begin prorating early termination fees. That's been an issue that customers have complained about. We hear them, we get it finally, and we're going to prorate early termination fees. So Verizon's already doing that, by the way, and the others, we're trying to get our billing systems up and running so that we can compete with them on that issue. And on the possible change of prices in their service, there were no complaints of that in 2006. That's the only year that we got data broken down from the AG's office. Subdivision 3, we would prefer the truth in billing language be part of that. The way it's drafted right now, it could require us to mandated detailed call billing, which I don't know if you guys read articles when the iPhone came out, people would get these huge, you know, paper bills because every call and every service was detailed, and customers have a lot of times opted out of that, and we would want them to continue to be allowed to opt out of that. I think that they may be attempting to deal with that based on the language that's provided today. And then also on third-party billing, I think they've attempted to get to the question of the customer versus the user on who has to authorize charges, and the Fair Credit Billing Act, that I think they've attempted to handle as well. So we'll have to take a look at that language as we move forward and continue the discussions. And then in Subdivision 5, where we talk about extensions of contracts and how customers should be notified if their contract is going to be extended, that's another thing that last fall all the major carriers said they are no longer doing it. So that's an issue that I think the industry is sort of trying to self-address. But also, we agree actually with sub A. It tells us that you have to let the customer know, you know, at the time that they accept a promotion or a change or whatever, that they're going to have their contract extended. But B on is very prescriptive. If they buy it over the internet, here's how you have to tell them. If they buy it in the store, here's how you have to tell them. Those kind of things. And we would just prefer that you mandate that the information must be provided and let the companies determine the best way to get that information to their customers. And with that, I'd like to introduce quickly Greg Mertz, who's with Gray Plant Moody, and he's going to discuss sort of the penalty issues. He's our local counsel here in St. Paul. And
Mr. Mertz.
I'll turn it to him.
Mertz, yes, Greg Mertz, M-E-R-Z, with the Gray Plant Moody Law Firm. Actually, we're in Minneapolis rather than St. Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to address the commission. I'm sorry, I often speak in front of the Public Utilities Commission, the committee, this morning. And I am going to focus today on what is Subdivision 6 of the amended language that was presented to you this morning, particularly in light of the small scale of the issue, as you've heard Ms. Knutson describe, and the declining trend, also as you've heard Ms. Knutson describe. I think it's particularly important that the committee give it serious consideration to what kinds of remedies are appropriate under the circumstances. And I think when you look at this particular provision, you should look at other provisions that we already have on the books and what remedy provisions are associated with those kinds of statutes. We have a statute on the books, 237.66, which is a provision that relates to disclosures in connection with local service. So local service providers have to provide their customers with certain kinds of disclosures. That provision doesn't contain any reference to 8.31. It provides that it can be enforced through the commission ordering cessation of any violation. This particular provision, if it's adopted, will be codified as part of the Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act. And that act includes a number of specific provisions addressing some telecom issues. For example, it deals with slamming. That's when your service provider changes your long-distance service. It regulates billing for 1-900 services, these information services. It concerns false and misleading email messages. All of those are kind of related consumer fraud provisions. None of those provisions refer to 8.31. In fact, the Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act has a specific remedy provision, and all of those provisions, similar to this one, rely on that specific remedy provision that provides for injunctive relief. And so, really, the proposal here is one to treat this particular issue, and again, we're just talking about a disclosure issue. We're not talking about every variety of fraud, but just the narrow issue of disclosure. It would treat that specific issue differently than any number of related kinds of issues, the way those issues are addressed in Minnesota, particularly given that you don't have a large and growing problem in the circumstance. It's not appropriate to treat this particular issue so differently than the way other similar issues are treated. And I thank the committee for it.
Thank you, Mr. Mertz. Is there any other witnesses on this? Seeing nothing, no one else wants to testify. Okay, Representative.
I do have one question for the witness, Mr. Chairman.
With one of these two?
Right.
Okay.
Not the the Ms. Knutson, the good
okay,
Irish
go
lady. The total number of subscribers versus the number of complaints, could you give us an idea? Maybe you already did and I missed it. But how many wireless subscribers are we talking about? How many complaints that your folks have actually tracked in 06 and 07?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative, we have, according to our data, we had 2006, we had 625 complaints. In 2007, 415. And again, that's the industry. The industry came together. We had a third party aggregate that data. And that shows a 210 drop in pure numbers. Now, as a percentage of the customer base, which grew by over 300,000 during that same time frame, it's about a 40% decrease. The AG's numbers are different. The AG shows 718 complaints in 2006 and 1,061 in 2007.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Ms. Knutson. The question, how many subscribers then total across the entire service area? Yes. How many people are we talking about, or how many contracts? And then the second question would be, has the Attorney General's Office verified or provided to you and your industry verification of where they get their numbers?
Ms. Knutson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer. Okay, first of all, there are about 3.7 million customers as of the end of 2007 in the state of Minnesota. It actually is about a 72% penetration rate. And when they say that, you know, that's all population. Of course, I have two devices, so it's a little bit different. But that's actually a little bit lower than the national average, which is 80%. And of those customers, we're showing, you know, a very small rate of voice complaints. I think I missed part of this.
Mr. Chair? Yes, you did the second part.
Would somebody turn off?
I'm embarrassed to say that's mine. I'm so sorry. At least it's over there, right? I'm so sorry.
Ms. Knutson, we have a member here who can shoot it off.
There are days I wouldn't mind. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, the question, the part that you missed is still, have you gotten any verification from our Attorney General as to where the AG's office gets their numbers? And I guess I'd add to it, have you provided them with your numbers and asked them to explain the difference?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, we have attempted a couple times to talk about complaint data with them, and that has not been met with a lot of interest. We have not received information on where they got their complaints. We don't know if it's a possibility of, you know, the same customer calling twice. Maybe they count it twice, we count it once. Maybe some of the complaints they've re-referred to them to because typically the AG's office or whomever receives the complaint will say, have you called your carrier yet? If they haven't, they direct them towards calling the carrier. So we don't know if those types of calls where they directed them towards the carrier and then it was resolved, we don't know what the difference is, and so it may be better to ask them.
Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if others have questions of the witnesses. I actually had a question for the author, so I can yield if there are others who have questions for the witnesses.
Are there any questions for the witnesses? Okay, then go ahead and the author.
Thank you.
We'll come back. Representative Mason, there's a question.
I do have someone that wants to testify on behalf of that. Do you want to hear that, or do you want to
ask
the question first?
Okay. Representative De La Forest, can we hear from him first?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Richter, Assistant Attorney General from the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Thank you.
What is your name?
That's Kai Richter, K-A-I.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Richter.
Hi. Here today, let me just briefly respond to some of the points that I've heard just raised. First of all, with respect to the complaints, there is a difference in the numbers. I can't say for certainty why there is that difference. What I can offer some suggestions as to why that difference may exist. The Attorney General's office does record complaints that we receive from consumers. I understand the industry claims that it meticulously records the complaints that are forwarded on to them. It may be that the carriers that they're getting back with are some subset of the numbers that we have received complaints about. I can also tell you that as of 2007, there were some issues with Sprint that we were, Sprint had requested us not to mediate certain complaints with Sprint pending the lawsuit, and I suspect that may explain some of the difference as well. But I think it misses the larger point here, which is that we are receiving a large number of complaints. I think I heard one of the representatives from the industry that indicate that one customer complaint is the problem. One of the rules of thumb that we use is that any customer complaint that we get really represents 100 individuals who don't complain to the office. And another point I wanted to emphasize is that the customer complaint data that was being bandied about, and really we have a difference of whether it's some hundreds or more hundreds of numbers of complaints for 2007, we're just talking about complaints that were coming into the Attorney General's office. There are also, of course, many, many complaints that go to the Better Business Bureau. And I think more fundamentally to the carriers themselves, and I would suspect, strongly suspect, that there would be many, many more complaints going to the carriers themselves for a customer that would presumably be their first attempted point of recourse rather than going to an outside party. But regardless, I think it's clear that there is a problem in terms of the number of complaints. Another point with respect to the language regarding point of sale, there's an objection that language is ambiguous. I just want to point out to the committee that I have reviewed the assurance of voluntary compliance that was worked out with other states, and it uses very similar language, sale transaction. So I think this alleged ambiguity with respect to point of sale really is a red herring. Third, with respect to the remedies, I would respectfully disagree with the counsel for the industry on that score. this legislature has recognized the need in other consumer protection statutes for a specific cross-reference to 8.31, and it is in many different statutes dealing with disclosures. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but just preparing for the hearing today, I found no less than 10 specific disclosure statutes that contain a cross-reference to 8.31. So it really would be the anomaly to not contain a specific cross-reference to 8.31. Moreover, there's no reason in this case to have such an anomaly take place and withdraw that 8.31 cross-reference from the bill. And I'd say that for a number of reasons. First of all, we are dealing here with an industry that has had a number of problems and should not receive favored treatment in comparison to other industries who have similar disclosure provisions, and those disclosure provisions contain a specific cross-reference to 8.31. Second, we're dealing here, as everyone on the committee well knows, with large companies. They are capable of defending themselves in court, and there's certainly no evidence of a history of abuse by this office in terms of prosecuting cases under 8.31. And third, I think it's also important here to note that we're dealing with, at least with respect to termination fees, small amounts in controversy. Typically $200, $150, in that range. These are not amounts that consumers can go out realistically, unless they're just doing it for purposes of principle, and go out and hire a lawyer by themselves. These are the very types of cases where the public depends on the Attorney General's office to remedy the situation, and to strip 8.31 from the bill would be especially misguided in this context. And I think it really would invite, make a terrible precedent, invite a situation where every time we have a consumer protection statute that becomes before this committee, other committees, or on the floor, we're going to have the argument that there should not be a reference to 8.31. So if the committee were to leave out the 8.31 language here, I think we'd be inviting similar arguments down the road on other consumer protection statutes, and I believe it would be misguided for that reason as well.
Representative LaForce, go ahead. You had a question. For, I believe, Representative Mason?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And based upon Mr. Richter's testimony, I guess I would turn it into a comment then. And I think, Mr. Richter, you make my argument for me. What troubles me about the bill, despite the changes, are the fact that there is a reference to 8.31, and I don't think that remedy ought to be available. You know, if you take a moment to read 8.31, and I hope the members would take a minute, I mean, we're talking about giving the Attorney General powers, for example, in Subdivision 2 to cause the arrest of people. 8.31 isn't appropriate in this case for small amounts in controversy. 8.31, on the other hand, contemplates situations where the scope and the breadth of consumer fraud is such that it begins to affect the general welfare. I mean, people losing their life savings, for example. Or if you watch the news last night, you see that there are apparently hundreds or thousands of people who now have a cloud hanging over title to their house, their biggest asset, because apparently a mortgage or a closer took their closing fees and never mailed the documents to get their titles recorded. That's what 8.31 ought to be about. It ought not to be about small amounts in controversy, and whether or not, you know, I know we have dueling statistics here about numbers, but when you look at a pool of 3.7 million subscribers, the numbers are small. I wish my complaint rate as a legislator was that small. Unfortunately, it's higher than that. I wish we all had that. So I would make an argument. I think 8.31 ought not to be available for those reasons. The assets and resources of the Attorney General ought to be reserved for far more serious cases.
Let's see. Well, Representative De La Force, 8.31 contains a lot of provisions that can be used in rare circumstances, too. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that I'm not sure we should be looking all the time at the ratio of complaints to industry. Otherwise, you'd almost never act. You're talking in the term of millions, and it's very unlikely that the Attorney General's office is going to get complaints even in the thousands. So I'm not quite sure that's an accurate measure. I think that's a little bit misleadingly low.
Why?
Not only for the reasons that Mr. Richter said, but that, you know, practically speaking, I don't think that should be the measurement of whether or not any law enforcement agency should act, is well, you've got this many million subscribers and only 500 or only 1,000 or only 10,000. I think critical mass can be a few in some instances. But my question for Mr. Richter was, just generally speaking, and I know this has come up in this committee and elsewhere a lot, about the data that your office can and can't release. And I don't want to put you too much on the spot in terms of speaking too broadly, but generally speaking, can you tell us what limitations you believe that your office has in terms of releasing data? I mean, can you release data, for example, by, is it just aggregate data? Can you release it as the carrier? Can you, you know, what kind of information is out there that you feel under state law you can disclose?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the two relevant provisions, I believe, are 13.39 and 13.65. 13.65 contains some heightened protections that are specific to consumer complaint data and impose limitations on the office in terms of what data that it can provide. Just from memory, and certainly there are restrictions with respect to name, address, other identifying information for consumers. I think it is fair to say, in general, that the aggregate data is easier for us to disclose, and which is why the industry has received that data from the office. But beyond that, I think it gets it becomes more difficult.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Richter, the you testified about complaints that are recorded in your office. In the number that you gave us today, because you also testified about additional complaints to the Better Business Bureau, can you tell me within the number that your office has provided for 2007, which I think is 1,061, can you tell us how many of those complaints came from the Better Business Bureau?
I can't, Representative, I'm not able to break that down. I haven't done a cross-reference. My point was simply that there are many avenues for consumers to complain. Some complain to our office, some complain to the Better Business Bureau, some complain to the carriers themselves. And it is possible that a consumer may complain to multiple organizations. My only point was that the complaints that our office receives are really a subset of the total number of complaints that go to whomever regarding the types of issues that this bill seeks to address. Just, if I may, with respect, I think the emphasis here has been on the quantity of complaints, and they're certainly large. I think it's also important to keep in mind the quality of the complaints. I do have an opportunity to review them because I'm working on the Sprint file, and some of the complaints that I see really are positively depressing. And we're not just talking here about, you know, 25-year-olds who are trying to game the system. I see complaints from elderly people as well who are on fixed incomes, and I'm sure the representatives from ARP perhaps can talk about this perhaps better than I can. But for these people, a $200 early termination fee really is a hardship. And without the ability of the Attorney General's office to come in and address the situation, then they're really left remedyless, because hiring a lawyer for $200 is just not in the cards for somebody like that. And so we really are trying to do the best for these people and trying to get ahead of the game here by introducing the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Richter. I'm actually just trying to deal with facts, and I have some major concerns with your testimony in that you're trying to help consumers, and you identify a specific group of seniors, which I think we're all very concerned with, and yet you're acting on apparently a handful of complaints out of 3.35 million, somewhere in their customers, and you and apparently some of our representatives think that we shouldn't be looking at that when we take the resources of your office to deal with this. And yet you don't contemplate the result of your actions. We've had testimony in here today that if subdivision or subpart 3, for instance, is enacted, it would affect the interactive waste response system. It would be millions of dollars to the industry. We as policymakers, not being in your office, we do need to consider and contemplate what happens when you throw this pebble into the pond. Where are the ripples going to go? And I would submit to you that it's very important for us to make this decision by knowing not only about the very sad situations you apparently have gotten to read and we haven't seen, but also what it could do to those same people if the millions of dollars in cost to the industry suddenly have to be foisted upon them. I mean, we need to be able to balance the number of complaints. Forgive me if some of my colleagues disagree. The total folks within the industry and what it means in terms of the solution your office is providing. And I would just note, I have another concern because your office was in here last year, I don't think it was you, testifying to this or a similar bill, and the statement was made by your office that you get 1,500 complaints annually. Now the numbers you're giving are 1,061 in the industry. You know, I understand we can get into a dispute over numbers, and that's not fair. It's not fair to your office. That's not fair to us. I guess what I would like to know is, can you provide us with, and this is why I asked about the Better Business Bureau, I would like to see the complaints. I'd like to know the basis. If this is so important, this proposed change in the law that your office is promoting, I'd like to know what impact it's going to have and be able to make the balance from a policy perspective as to how it's going to affect the public generally as well. I mean, you want to provide some type of remedy to these folks, but at the same time, you don't want to provide a remedy that's going to cost them and everybody else more. And maybe it would help us as policymakers if we could see those complaints and get a feel for what you already apparently have. So I'd ask if we could get that information.
We certainly will review that request. I don't believe we can provide that data under 13.65. I believe it's specifically prescribed, but we certainly will take that request and consider it. And
Representative Holver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mason, what were the remedies in the bill as introduced?
Before the original, what the amendment put in, we're putting back.
Well, Mr. Chair, then where did the remedies get taken out?
They were taken out at the Commerce Committee.
And I wasn't on that committee, but what was the rationale for that?
It was following some of the arguments about the appropriateness of using it. But this is typically, the 8.31, to my understanding, is typically what there is. This has been used by the AG's office previously.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I mean, I know it's not a hard, fast rule, but generally you try and respect the work of other committees, and if the Commerce Committee deemed that these remedies were not appropriate as they weighed other business issues, and I mean, I know we didn't...
Representative Holberg, the remedies is this committee's business. It really doesn't belong in theirs. It belongs in this committee.
Oh.
So it does, it is appropriate for this committee.
Mr. Chair, it kind of goes back to, I think, an infamous meeting of last year where you can't separate the remedy from the policy issue. And Commerce has the job of evaluating business practice across the whole spectrum of different components of business and weighing that out. And so I do have respect for what they said relative to this, and certainly it's part of the amendment, and if and when we get the bill and have an ability to even act on an amendment, you know, we can tackle that at that point. But the Commerce Committee obviously had a reason for deleting that part of the bill, and Representative DeForest, I'm assuming, was there. I just have some concern relative to that.
Representative Lowy.
Mr. Chair, in relationship to this question, as I read your amendment, I guess the question for the author is the penalty for $25,000 back in then?
Yes. Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative DeLaForest and others that are on Commerce can probably help me with this as well, but my understanding is that the reason that we felt it was appropriate to take it out is that there are cases where companies would come in and as a company policy might do things that would do damage to customers, and maybe in those cases perhaps it's appropriate. But say there's a gentleman or a lady who works at a mall or something, you know, just on a counter and makes a mistake now and or offers misinformation. Now it's $25,000 an appropriate penalty at that point, and the consensus at Commerce was that it was not. So that was kind of, you know, obviously for the big offenders or the company-wide kind of, so that's why we felt it was appropriate. So
well,
I just offer that.
Literally, that the $25,000 is up to for that woman. She's not going to get hit with that. But we have caucus in 6 minutes, so we just found out we don't have the bill. So we'll lay this over immediately, not to take up immediately. We're going to have the bill after session is over. And we're meeting in 300 North about 30 minutes after session. So this meeting is recessed until 30 minutes after session,
Mr. Chair.
At the beginning. Representative Lesh moves House File 635, second endorsement. No, it hasn't been amended yet. For passage and referral to rules. So then Representative Lesh moved the 1459 amendment to get it in the shape the author wanted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Then the Representative Lesh removes his motion to pass House File 635 and send it to the floor as to rules as amended. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No.
Carries. Thank you, Representative. Next file is.
Good, Chair. Thank you very much.
Next file is House File 3610.
Which one did he say?
37. Yeah. What file is it? Is there anybody here on House File 3371, birth record access allowed to adopted persons? Three people? Four people? They're not. They're, all of those are advocates for the bill? Well, that's what I said. Is there anybody that's opposed to that bill? Okay. Why don't we take Representative Tinglestad then while we're waiting for the other.
What's that?
Okay. Representative Tinglestad, why don't we take yours while we're waiting for the next bill. Does somebody want to move?
I will move the bill. I will move House File 3371. But I need to know where it's going. Sorry. Should have
General Register.
To the General Register.
Thank you. Representative Bigham moves House File 3371 to pass and go to the General Register. Representative Tinglestad, you have I believe it's your A4 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's a clarifying language, so if you can put that on, that would be great.
Representative Tingelstad, Representative Olin moves the S4 amendment. Together in shape, the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Okay, Representative Tingelstad, go ahead and explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This legislation deals with adoption and adopted people age 19 and older having access to their original birth certificates. It was in Chairman Thiessen's committee last week, passed unanimously. And there's several other states that have passed this legislation recently, and certainly adoption and society's attitudes towards adoption have changed over the last 20 years or so. And there's been a grassroots effort, and this same bill is being heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee right now with Senator Rest, and so I only have about half of the people here who have been waiting to watch this bill today, and I just want them to raise their hands. They are birth parents, adoptive parents, and adoptive people who have worked on this legislation, and so we believe it brings together all the issues. This year, a key factor was also getting Children's Home Society on board with this legislation, and they work directly with Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities to come together with this compromise bill. So there's a lot of compromises that have gone into this issue, and we believe it's ready for prime time this year, Mr. Chair. And so with the language that you just adopted in the A4 amendment, that is clarifying information that came together since we were in the last committee. And at some point here, it would be appropriate to probably bring up a couple of people from the Department of Health who will testify that with this language, there's no fiscal note on the bill. So with that, that's a brief overview of what this legislation does. The handout that you got from the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform basically highlights the issues within this bill. The key factor this year is new information that we received from the Minnesota Department of Health, which says that the affidavits of disclosure are about 90% of the affidavits on file. The affidavits of non-disclosure are about 10%. And with this compromise legislation, we are honoring the non-disclosure so that those birth parents that don't want this information released to adult adoptees, that will be honored. So that was a key piece in bringing this together. Some more information there about national adoption organizations. And then, excuse me as I'm losing my voice here, an editorial that Senator Rest and I had published in the Star Tribune last week that relates to some of the issues around this legislation. So with that, Mr. Chair, if we could have a brief testimony from one of the advocates here, Penelope Needham, who is with this adoption group, and can tell you a little bit more about why it's important.
Ingleson, could you really limit it? We have a huge calendar this afternoon, and so hopefully it could be limited.
Sure. I'm Penelope Needham. I'm an adopted person and also a member of the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, who supports this legislation. It is a compromise bill, as Representative Tingelstad said, in conjunction with the adoption agencies and the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, Concerned United Birth Parents, First Nations Orphans Association, and Reuniting Minnesota. It's based on the data housed at the State Department, and they give those birth mothers who do not want their information released continued privacy in that. And a grassroots organization, Passionate, and it's been coming back year after year for nearly 20 years now trying to get this legislation passed and adoptees to have access to the original birth certificates. We have also invited the adoption agencies to join us in the effort of our public awareness. when this legislation passes. Then your form group takes us through the course after receiving the legislation, and we can promise to spread the word after it passes. We are helped with the constant outpouring of the media that is already reaching Minnesotans. I don't know if you saw USA Today, but there was an article in the net on one of the largest advertising agencies in the state has gathered data last week saying that in the last year, there are 56 million households across the country who have heard about the approach of adopting access. In their total, 7.5 million households have been exposed to printed publications, and this number reflects newspapers, magazines, and doesn't include broadcast media. With that, that was taken in voting with NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, USA Public Radio, even on Monday, having an online program devoted to this legislation. Although the both leaders of every EU made an adoption decision, and they are aware of that change. And the majority of both leaders will welcome the change. The bill does provide a mechanism for those who will not want that change, and the affidavits from the Miles Corner will be banned. Between now and 2009, the date of the American Report of Statewide Public Awareness Effort, that is running in other states that have passed similar legislation. Those states should not need the fiscal note to spread the word. The results speak for themselves. Oregon celebrates a decade of access this year. New Hampshire is celebrating the year this past summer. And we celebrated in Tennessee, Alabama, and Denver, and soon to take effect tomorrow. Each health department in the states reports positive experiences. Others could possibly report a basic human needs of information about oneself and access to the state's vital records that are so vital to each and every one of us. We join with the best agencies of serving, sort of treating the families well who, like us, want only the best for adopted children who are not adults and for both parents and adopted parents. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Leader.
Representative Holberg, do you have a question?
I have lots of them, Mr. Chair. This is a major, major change in the rights of birth mothers and for their privacy, and I have a couple of questions, and I'd like to ask them at this time.
Okay.
Can you tell me current law of, is there any access to a birth mother who is deceased? In other words, Mr. Chair, if the mother is deceased and there's no affidavit on file providing for access, what happens under current law?
Do you want somebody from the department?
I believe it can be released.
Mr. Chair, do you know that for a fact? You say, I believe. I'm not sure that that is the case. I guess my point, Mr. Chair,
if you have an expert from the department, Representative
Hino
said, why don't you have that person?
Thank you, Mr. Golden from Department of Health, Vital Records.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'm going to, I am just very strongly opposed to this. And for people that might think I have a bias one way or another, I have two adopted siblings, and I also have a close family member that gave up a child for adoption pre-82 that would be affected by this. And what we are doing here is that if a birth mother in the next year doesn't figure out what's going on and puts in this paperwork, then that birth record becomes public. And birth mothers across the state, when they gave up their babies for adoption prior to 82, when they had this ability to either say they wanted to be contacted or not, they're not all going to be notified of this campaign. And we are taking away their right to privacy with no respect to what's happened in their lives, whether or not they've told their families about this child, whether or not things have changed. I mean, I just think that this is major, major policy change. If, in fact, the campaign in this bill was to contact birth mothers and give them the option of signing the affidavit, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But if they miss this opportunity in this one-year window period of time, then those records are going to be opened. And I don't think that they're going to be able to, with their campaign, contact birth mothers who may have moved outside of the state, or whatever, to let them know that their right to privacy that they had at the time of the adoption has now been overturned.
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Holberg, the answer to your question about the ability to release it, if you actually have the bill in front of you, if you look at the 1R page, you will see that there is a section of statute that is 259.89, and it's subdivision 3 there, and it is the failure to notify a parent. And if I understand your question correctly, you're asking what happens, for example, if the birth mother is deceased. And what this lays out is the process by which the adoptee is able to get this. And so what would happen is the department would send the request for this to the Department of Human Services and follow this bigger picture that's here. And it depends a little bit on the time of the adoption. If the adoption was prior to August 1st of 1977, that person could go to a court to obtain a court order where the court would presumably weigh some types of interest. That's outside of the department. We simply respond to the court order that we receive. And then in the second case, you will see if the adoption was on or after August 1st of 1977, what we would do is we would look to see if there was an affidavit of non-disclosure. And if there's not an affidavit of non-disclosure, we would follow the instructions here and release the information.
I appreciate the clarification. While the bill, as presented in front of us, if you look on page 3 of the bill, it opens it completely up without, for everybody, without any judicial review. And again, you know, there are women that gave up babies for adoption that they've gone on with their life. They've, and to just totally open up these records in the way that this bill does, I just think is really unfair to those women. When they gave those babies up for adoption, many of them were given a right to privacy, and I don't feel that this information campaign is going to reach everybody.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we believe that that birth mothers always remember that they were birth mothers, and that they, when they relinquish their children, that they haven't forgotten, and that their antenna are very adept at picking up information about adoption and changes in the law. They still do have the right to follow that form for non-disclosure. Not just the ones who did it before, but it won't be a form available in the future also. So they can still say no, and they still get protected if they want that privacy. So the statistics from the Department of Health suggest that that's a very small number of women who want that, but that will be earned. And these adopters will not get their birth certificates. And it's not really public information, it's only released to the adopted person. Not dead cases available online, for instance, so you can't just go and shoot for a birth certificate. It's given to a person to whom it owns their birth certificate, or it's about them.
Mr. Chair, number one, the mothers that are deceased don't have the antenna. They have no right to assert their right to privacy. And number two, then once you have that original birth certificate, being able to trace family members or half-siblings, etc., that whole thing opens up. And again, birth mothers may have their antenna up about this issue, but whether they still live in Minnesota or someplace else, I just think that what this bill does, again, if the campaign was to make contact to birth mothers and give them the option of opening up this contact, I would be 100% in favor of this. But it does not do that. It does not give them that option. And in particular, in the case of the deceased, they have no rights.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we're hoping that this won't prevent or continue to prevent people from the contact that they want. And it's been in the past, it's the reverse. A small minority have wanted to keep things private, and this is still the honor for that small minority. But the vast majority of families want to give their information to their children, and adoptees want to town where we came from. So we're hoping that this will change.
Mr. Chairman, I know you want to move along and get this stuff done, and I can appreciate that, but what isn't it our job to protect that small minority? I mean, they had a right that we're going to take away from them in this bill. If they're not on the ball enough to fill in their paperwork before July 1st of 2009, and the issue of the ones that are deceased, they have no opportunity to protect their rights.
That's what this committee has to decide, and I think Representative Tamar, was it your hand or Representative Cornish? Representative Cornish.
Being an adoptive parent, I take a little bit of a different view on this. The only way I could find out for my son when he asked was by trickery and investigation on my own through vague descriptions of the mother and searching annuals in high school and finally making an arrangement because the information was protected. And so I'm hoping that there can be a compromise here, because when my kid wanted to find out who his mom was, I definitely wanted to find out. And for a lot of reasons. So if there is some compromise here that you can protect the people that don't want to give it and give it to the CR, then I support the bill if it can be explained in layman's language. But I have a hard time seeing the deceased person's wish if they're deceased, why they, you know, I have a little trouble following that one. But for the ones that are living in care.
Okay, looks like there's no further questions or discussion. I asked earlier if there was any opposition. Nobody raised their hands. Is there any? Okay, then we'll go back to the motion by Representative Bigham, I believe.
Yes, I'll read a memo.
To pass this and refer to the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Next, we'll do House File 1239, I guess. Representative Simon moved his where are the amendments?
Everybody else is reading.
Okay.
anachronistic.
I think 1417 is yours. Getting to that, just trying to get it straight here. Okay, we've already had Representative Simon move his bill. Now Representative Simon moves the 1417 amendment, and everybody has it finally. So that's to get it in the shape the author wants.
Yes, Mr. Chair, before that, I'll move the bill. I don't think I moved
the bill. Yes, you did move the bill.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll move the 1417,
which is the lead. To get it in the shape you want. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Okay. And, Representative Simon, I believe there's been some discussion. There's apparently two, there's the Senate and
yep.
yours, and what I'd like to do is get the two sides on the table, so I'm going to let Representative Holberg move her language, and you've moved yours,
oh.
and then you can go at, basically, so that you can, so we can understand the two sides. I think she has the Senate version, isn't
she
it?
She does. But I'd like to explain the bill just briefly, if
okay,
I could.
Okay, very shortly. I just wanted to...
No, that's
when you get into the differences, I wanted both in front of people.
That's fine. Members, thanks a lot. First of all, Mr. Chair, thank you for giving the hearing, and I really appreciate that. Members, this is the bill pertaining to childhood sex abuse, and I know it's a tough issue. People don't like to talk about it. They don't like to talk about it. No one does. It's very uncomfortable. But it's important that we do. Sex abuse, obviously, as we all know, is a crime of secrecy. Victims very often do not have the courage to speak out until years later, and it's particularly true when the victim is a child, because a child might lack the emotional skills to come forward, especially when the perpetrator is a family member or a trusted adult that that child knows. And a child in particular is subject to powerful forms of manipulation, particularly in this area. So it's no wonder then that sometimes it takes many, many years for that person, once they're an adult, to come to grips with what happens to them as a child. So it's only later in life, very often, that the child victim will connect the anguish of the present with the crimes and abuses of the past, and I've seen it. These folks have been in my office, I've encountered them elsewhere, and it's a very, very tough issue. And there are people we've seen in their 40s, 50s, or older who are just now coming to grips with what happened to them, and who are suffering, believe me, from their childhood sex abuse, but who have no recourse. So a little bit of history, members, and some of you have heard this before, but I think it bears repeating. In 1989, so almost 20 years ago, this legislature enacted a delayed discovery statute. And that language is still on the books. It's still on the books right now. That is what is on the books right now that we are trying to amend. And that language said that a person could bring an action, quote, within 6 years of the time the plaintiff knew or had reason to know that the injury was caused by sexual abuse, end quote. So if within 6 years of the time that the plaintiff knew or had reason to know that the injury was caused by the sexual abuse, not 6 years within the time of the sexual abuse, 6 years within the time that they knew or had reason to know that the injury that they were suffering was caused. That's what we enacted, we or our forebears, I guess you could say, in 1989. And then a few years later, in 1996, there was a Supreme Court case called the Blachowiak case.
And what came out of the Blachowiak case was that the Supreme Court interpreted that language, again, still on the book, if you open up the statute book, interpreted that language that I just described to say, well, that really means 6 years from the age of majority, so age 24. So if you sue past the age of 24, you're out of luck. Even though the words still on the statute book say within 6 years of the time the plaintiff knew or had reason to know the injury was caused by the abuse. So, as introduced, this bill sought to go back to the pre-Blachowiak days. So what at least we who have pushed this bill thought was more faithful to what the legislature did in 1989. That's what we originally wanted, and if I were to wave a magic wand, that's what I would still want. The reality is that we all have to see compromise, and that's what we've done here today. If you look, and I know, members, you're being buried in paper here, but if you look at the handout, it's just a simple table here. This sort of depicts. Do you have that, members?
No.
You don't have it. Can the pages hand out the table, please?
They're not copies.
Oh, okay.
We're
looking for the
I think it's important because it depicts kind of physically the difference between the delete everything amendment that we just passed and what as the bill as introduced.
I don't think there's copies.
There we go.
Okay. Yeah, there, I think there
are.
Can you please hand out the...
Of the table.
Yeah, sorry, this is supposed to be handed out. It's the table. Fine.
Tell me what the pain that people.
Go ahead, Representative.
Okay. Thank you, members, for your patience here. If you look at the table, what's before you in the form of the Delete Everything Amendment is a considerable, major compromise. Some would say, and some have said, major retreat. And I think members should understand how painful a compromise this is for all sides involved. And the sheriff will go into that in a minute. But as you can see, I think a typical person looking at this would say this is a beyond just a compromise. The original bill and the one that I brought up on the floor as amendment last year, but that's now before us, the original bill would say what the language currently says in the statute book and what I still continue to believe the Supreme Court got wrong in the Blachowiak case, but that battle's behind us. The original bill would have reinstated what we did in 1989, said 6 years within that time that they knew or should have known of the sexual abuse. So that could go for many, many years into the future. We've given that up. Now, in consultation with the religious communities, with the school boards, with the daycare providers, we've come to, I think, substantial agreement on this. So today, then the bill before you now, as we've just amended it, says 17 years from the age of majority, which in almost every case will be 35 years old. And I'll explain that in a minute, and that will go to what I anticipate being the Holbrook Amendment. But let me move on. The original bill said, as to the institution that employed a person who was a perpetrator, that there was vicarious liability for all range of damage. Here, one cause of action, negligence. That's it. Before, there was a window within which time bar claims could be revived. In other words, people who, by our legislative action today, would be sort of out of luck, there would be a 1 year or 2 year or some window within which they could bring their claims, and then the bill would kick in for everybody. We give it up on the window. There is no window here. So that's something that we are no longer doing. And then finally, the limitation for an action against the individual perpetrator, not the institution, not religious, social, cultural, any institution. It used to run along the same line for the institution. Now, and all the stakeholders, at least who were in these meetings, agreed that for the actual perpetrator, the individual, not the employer, not the entity with whom that perpetrator was affiliated, now there's an unlimited statute of limitations. So people have some redress in their life. They can still go after the actual person, the individual who did this to them. They just can't go after the institution, or the employer, or the entity, or the organization. So I think you'll agree on the face of it, I hope you will, members, that this is, to call it a compromise is putting it lightly. It's more than a compromise. It's a very painful confession for a lot of people. And you've probably gotten some emails from people on the other side of this who think that this bill goes too far in the direction, and that it's a sellout or it's a betrayal or something like that. And it's been very, very difficult. People who don't want us to go this far, but we've done it in the name of reaching some sort of peaceful settlement of these very difficult issues. And I just want you to remember one more thing before I hand it over to the testifier or before Mr. Chair, if that's your...
I'm going to put them both on so we can...
Then we'll hand it over to the
full right at...
Okay.
It's hard enough for members to understand this rather than getting a whole side and then a whole other side.
Fair enough. Let me just say, and I think all of us agree about this, all the stakeholders and everyone, that the issue here is this, that... You know, when these perpetrators, these molesters, basically, when they're not dealt with, either civilly or criminally, when they're uncaught and unpunished, it is very, very likely that they will do this again to other people. Very likely. And that's why I suspect the bill has the backing of, there are 30 members on this bill, Republican, Democrat, Liberal, Conservative, that are authors on this bill, and that was the tougher bill, let alone this considerable compromise. And it's why I suspect that the County Attorneys Association and many other organizations support this. Mr. Chair, let me just speak to the one issue that's going to be before us real quickly. And I don't know if you want to do it through the Holberg Amendment or you want to just have her...
I want to have her... I'm going to take her amendment so that we get it on the table so that we can discuss the differences that there are. Okay. Otherwise, you're discussing something...
That's fine.
I just... So we're going to... Representative Holberg, you have the 1452 amendment, I believe?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Holberg, I assume you want to move that.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Holberg moves the 1452 amendment. And I'm going to let... Since Representative Simon has explained his amendment... Different, the original bill and his amendment, I'll give you some time to explain yours, and then we'll go back and try and sort it out. So, Representative Holberg, can you explain your amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my amendment deals directly with the chart on the first box, the issue on the limitation for action against an institution. And my understanding is that my amendment is referred to as the Senate language, and it has a hard 35 years of age. And so, in other words, when the victim would reach age 35, their ability to recover any kind of damages from the institution would be over. In the bill that Representative Simon has put in front of us in the form of the 1417 amendment, it would allow for 17 years from the age of majority, and it would allow tolling. In other words, you could extend beyond 35 years for various reasons, and I'm sure Representative Simon will give us a list of those. And so it's a small difference, and I wasn't in the negotiations, and I don't know if this is a result of a misunderstanding or what, why we have these two things, but I don't think that... I need to commend the people that have been working on this bill. This is a very difficult issue. I don't think this is a blow-up-the-deal kind of thing. Representative Simon was agreeable to me offering this amendment for the committee to have a discussion on whether or not we're having a hard 35 years or if, in fact, we're going to allow some tolling to occur.
Representative Holberg, basically what you have is a statute of repose here, which the attorneys understand and which we've done on several other bills and laws in the last few years. One was, I know, on the on Palms, defective Palms, there was put in a statute of repose on that just a couple of years ago. So that's what technical.
For us poor lay people, it's just on your birthday.
Yes. And Representative Holbert, my understanding is yours is the exact language from the Senate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well.
Let's see. Representative Simon. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, thank you for feeling in good faith on this issue. I know you and I have both been involved with it for a while, and we both feel passionately about it. I respectfully oppose the Holbert Amendment. She's right that, you know, this is the only thing that we're still disagreeing on. Everything else is total agreement. The question is how best to state 35 years old. We all agree in concept and as a result of the negotiations that 35 years old is the top of the land we've reached. The question is here is how do you want to state it? Do you want to do it by, as Chair Mullery said, a statute of repose, which is an absolute cap, 35 years old no matter what, or do you want to do, as I would guess 90% of our time-based statutes do, which is a statute of limitations, which is to say 17 years from the age of majority. That's usually how we do it in the vast majority of cases, although, as you said, Mr. Chair, there are some exceptions. We would be making an exception by putting a hard cap at 35 years old, and here's why the difference. Somebody might say, hey, well, don't they say the same thing? 35 years old and 17 years after the age of majority, that seems to be the same thing. Not exactly, because if you do it the way that we think is best, and that I guess 90%+ of statutes do, what you're saying there is you're saying there could be, under certain very remote circumstances, some tolling, which is a fancy lawyer word for delaying of the statute of limitations. For example, this may seem absurd, but it could happen. If someone's in a coma, if someone's totally incapacitated, if someone is overseas for certain reasons and absolutely can't exercise their rights due to factors totally beyond their control. I'm not talking about someone, you know, moving to Brazil for 2 years to lengthen the statute of limitations. Someone who cannot exercise their rights. It's very tough to do. It's very tough to prove. It's very tough to get. It almost never happens. And I would imagine that in 99% or north of 99% of the cases, the way we want it phrased, 17 years after the age of majority will be 35 years old. But on very rare occasions, we think, consistent with the way we do things, the vast majority of the time, the vast majority of laws, that it's better stated, just in case there's something that we even here today can't contemplate, to make sure that it's 17 years after the age of majority. So that's the reason. I'm happy to say that's the only sticking point here. You know, a year ago, there were a lot more sticking points than that. This is the only thing. It's at the will of the committee which way you want to do it. The Senate chose one way. I respectfully disagree. I think the best way to do it is consistent with the way we do most of our laws, which is a statute of limitations, not a statute of repose, and that's really it.
One thing represents finding is that most cases are 17 years from the age of majority. Most cases are either 2 years or 6 years. I don't know of anything where we go anything over 6 years, but Representative Smith has got a...
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Of the author or of staff, I heard you testify that your statute of limitations is preferable and or at 90%+ of the cases as opposed to the amendment containing the statute of repose, that it yours language doesn't affect a lot. How does it affect men and women under arms in the military overseas pursuant to the Soldiers and Sailors Civil Rights Act of 1941 or whatever?
Yep. That's a great question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, we can't affect that one.
No, that one we can't. But I'd like to turn it over, if I could, to Julie Parris to introduce herself and she has something to say on that.
On this point?
Yes, on this point. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Parris, I'm the Policy Director and General Counsel for the National Association to Prevent Sexual Abuse of Children. Thanks for your time today. I'll be brief. I did want to directly answer Representative Smith's question because we've been asking this question as well. The Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act directly would preempt any statute of limitations issue that would prevent them from tolling in cases of being overseas, in cases of disability where they're unable to exert their rights. We're not sure, I don't think, how a statute of repose would be affected by the Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act. That's not addressed in the act at all, and it hasn't been addressed in any case law that we can find. It may be that the preemptive language in that act would affect the statute of repose as well. I don't know that we have the answer to that at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon. It's my understanding, and I started to get the difference between this over the course of the past couple of years, is this agreement was passed and went down. And as I understand it, I think I like your language as is, and not Representative Holberg's amendment, because if I understand it correctly, we're talking about a situation where we're deciding, are we going to give a benefit or advantage to the institution or to the victim? And I think all things being equal, we gotta give the tie to the victim in these cases. I spent many years in the church. I was a seminary for many years, and I saw how they shuffled these people around all the time. And I saw clergy members come and go, and people turn their heads to what was going on. And I was right there. I saw it. Now, I think if, in fact, you've got young people that can't actually recognize that, of what's going on, because they're young, they're innocent, and then we're only adding insult to injury to say, well, you're in a coma, or you're overseas, unable to do anything, so because you were additionally burdened, we're going to penalize you for that. Whereas everyone else who wasn't additionally burdened, in the statute of repose, gets their time to fix that right at 35, but these other people who maybe didn't have that advantage and maybe were disadvantaged by whatever kind of conditions you say, Representative Simon, all of a sudden we're going to penalize them more. And I understand the nuance is slim, but based on what I saw, I think it's a wonderful member who will put in that.
Representative Owen, did you have her hand? Okay, there was somebody else on the list. Maybe it was somebody else. Is there somebody in that wants to testify on this issue? Mr. Eisenzimmer?
Mr. Chair, my name is Andrew Eisenzimmer. I'm legal counsel for the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis. I'm appearing here, however, this afternoon on behalf of the Minnesota Religious Council. I'm pinch hitting actually for Dan Conley, whose mother is seriously ill. We at the Minnesota Religious Council have worked with both sides on this issue, trying to address the various concerns and issues that have been raised. It's important, I think, to begin to recognize that a statute of limitation or a statute of repose doesn't really create or destroy any substantive rights. What they really do is set limits within which a plaintiff can assert their cause of action. So the characterization today between the statute of limitation and the statute of repose is a good way to put it. But basically what the difference is between a statute that that's Representative Simon's version that would allow 17 years after a person reaches the age of majority, and the Senate version, which is Representative Holberg's amendment, which would allow a claim, as she states, a hard age 35 limit. Now, we think the distinction in that really goes back to the Blachowiak case that Representative Simon referred to earlier. Blachowiak was a major interpretation of the 1989 statute, which was the original statute that was passed, the so-called delayed discovery statute. And Blachowiak indeed did say that a plaintiff who was sexually abused as a minor has 6 years from the time they reach the age of majority, or in other words, until age 24 to bring these claims. But I can tell you, based upon my own experience as a litigator litigating these cases since the mid-1980s, that there have been dozens and dozens and dozens of attempts to further extend that six-year period from age 18 beyond age 24. And the concern that we have at the Minnesota Religious Council is that using the same language, 17 years beyond age 18, invites the same kind of repeated litigation to try to further extend that 17-year period. For example, the cases we've seen over the last number of years since the Blachowiak decision in 1996, there have been attempts to extend that six-year period by claiming fraud, fraudulent concealment, repressed memory, equitable estoppel, revitalized memories, a breach of fiduciary duty. There was one claim where someone claimed that they were depressed and distracted by their injury and thus couldn't bring their claim within that six-year period. So what we think is important is to set a definitive outside limit. And we think that we have ourselves, at the Minnesota Religious Council, been very willing to extend that substantially. So instead of a 6 years from the age of majority statute, which is, again, the current statute, as interpreted by the court in Bukoyak, we've agreed to extend that another 11 years but to age 35 and make it a statute of repose. That adds the definitiveness. What that then allows is that there won't be these further attempts to repeated litigation and costing both sides time and expense litigating these questions about trying to further extend it beyond the 17 years that would be available under Representative Simon's legislation. So we think that's the important thing to look at here. Now, questions have been raised about people who are incapacitated, people who are in the military service, and certainly those issues have been wrestled with by the courts. As someone noted here, the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act would protect people in military service. I'm a Vietnam veteran combat, a Vietnam War combat veteran myself, and I can guarantee you I would not support any legislation that would somehow restrict the rights of our servicemen and women to bring these kinds of claims. Regarding people who might be incapacitated in some fashion, obviously they can have legal representatives. They're going to have a conservator or someone appointed to represent their interests, so that person can prosecute these claims. So we think the hard 35 age cutoff will substantially reduce the litigation and attempts to further extend the period of time within which victims have to bring these claims.
We've got to move this on. We're way back up, and we've got bills lined up. So all in favor of the Holberg Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
I say it carries.
Division.
What do you want, a division?
Oh, you said carried?
Oh, I was saying it carried. Do you want a division or not?
I'll call it a division.
Okay, you call it a
division either way.
All in favor, raise your hands.
Yeah. We're so used to that.
Just doing my math.
Nine. All opposed. Eight. Holberg Amendment carries 9-8. Simon, back to your bill amended by the Holberg Amendment. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, all I would say, I know we have other bills to move on. I just I want to thank all the stakeholders who met here. Like I said, everyone, people first approach me on the floor elsewhere. People don't like to talk about it. It's awkward. It's uncomfortable. It's downright painful for a lot of people, but I understand that. So I thank everyone's indulgence, but it's a very, very important thing. I think what we're about to do here is a real step forward. It's a painful compromise, a concession, but I think it's something that ought to happen. So I just thank all the group. Mr. Eisenhower,
Representative Simon, there's a testifier for your side. I thought there was an agreement that nobody from either side would. There's a Mr. Mahal. Is he part of?
Not someone that does.
Oh, okay. Can you testify in like a minute or so?
If I got opportunity to answer.
Okay. Very quickly. Just Representative Simon, this goes to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to call for a roll.
Tom Mahal, from Hastings, Arizona. I don't think the bill goes far enough. I don't think you understand the issues. Coming forward is a major thing for any victim of child sexual abuse. The whole society is against us. You stack the cards. You haven't provided us with the services we need to heal. You haven't provided us with opportunities. Just one little point. A friend of mine had to go into psych ward because he was suicidal. Of the 16 men in that ward, 100% of them were victims of child sexual abuse. We aren't being treated for what the issues are. Society fails to want to even deal with us. And yet we're supposed to even now have this big window of 35 years. It doesn't work for many. You as society want to run from this issue, hide from it. and you don't have any compassion and understanding for the issues that we face. Most, I've been involved in this issue for 7 years now. I belong to a website called Male Survivors. Most of the people coming to that site are 40, 45, 50 years old, are finally hit rock bottom, and are beginning to understand and relate the causal effect of their issues to back to the child sexual abuse. If you really want this issue to stand, and you want it to be a issue of, okay, 35, oh yeah, what a magical age. We can come up with some little limit and extend the statute, oh, big deal. It still is not enough. You are not doing enough as a society, as legislators, to reach out to the victim. You should be reaching out to them in grade school, high school, college. You should be demanding that there's equal opportunity for healing, especially for male survivors. Most of the funding that are treated on for rape issues go to women. They're run by women's organizations. Males do not have the support we need. And I do not think this bill goes far enough. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might just real briefly okay. here. Mr. Mahold, you know, I think it's really unfair of you to say that this body doesn't have understanding or compassion. When I carried this bill, there were members of this body that are childhood victims of sexual assault, staff members. You know, I think that you are making some pretty broad assumptions in your statements, and this is an issue that's very difficult to talk about, that people have very deep feelings, and you know that, but when you come to the testifier table and make these accusations of the legislature that we don't understand or we don't know, you're making assumptions about the members here and what their life experiences are that are just not fair.
We don't have any further time for testimony. Mr. Mahal, we have to keep going here.
I understand, sir.
And
I think she's mistaken.
We understand that you don't agree, Mr. Mahal. Representative Simon renews his motion, and I believe he asked for a roll call.
Representative Bigham.
Aye.
Representative Cornish.
Nay.
Representative De La Forest.
Aye.
Representative Emmer.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kalin.
Aye.
Representative Cole.
Aye.
Representative Kranz. Representative Lesch.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Olin.
Aye.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Simon.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Westrum.
No.
It passes. Still on the agenda is Representative Loeffler, 3610. Representative Loeffler, Representative Smith, is that okay, Representative Smith?
I know.
That's okay.
Okay, those are okay. Apparently, Representative Smith is not there. Would somebody else? Will somebody move? Okay, I'll do it. Representative Loeffler, what did you do to everybody on this committee? Representative Loeffler, the chair moves House File 3610. Do you have an amendment, my understanding?
We do. I haven't seen a copy of it, but I understand it's coming around. This is to deal with members. The amendment is to deal with a situation that was called to our attention by an entity that accesses limited information, as we understand it, to assist in enrolling people in public and programs, and so it's response to that concern. And
The chair will move the A1 amendment together and shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you.
Explain your whole bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill basically is to assure that we don't start confusing medical treatment and death history in terms of treatment decisions. And I'm going to ask Mr. Harrington from the Attorney General's office to go through it in more detail.
I'm sorry, what was his name?
Harrington.
Mr. Harrington.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Harrington. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's office. And thank you for conducting this important hearing and taking the time to hear this bill. As you may be aware, news accounts indicate that a company is developing a service that will compile data on the medical payment histories of individuals and sell that data to healthcare providers to help determine the likelihood that patients will pay their bills. And I believe you should have these articles in front of you. Members, it's no secret that one-third of Americans have problems with medical debt, and even the two-thirds of Americans that have health insurance still have unaffordable deductibles and co-pays. More than 1 million Minnesotans spend 10% or more of their pre-tax income on health care costs. Now, medical debt is fundamentally different from other kinds of debt because ordinarily people do not choose to become sick or injured. People often seek medical treatment because they have to. Now, one risk in not protecting the privacy of an individual patient's medical payment history is that the patient may not get the medical care that they need because of the debt load that they carry. Indeed, healthcare providers may choose to ration healthcare on the basis of a patient's debt. This process is a frightening reality for many Minnesotans. So this bill seeks to solve this pressing problem, and it's tailored to protect the privacy of financial and medical debt information. Briefly, the Act 1 prohibits healthcare providers from disclosing an individual patient's financial or medical debt information to another entity. And 2, it prohibits healthcare providers from obtaining or using information from any entity that gathers, maintains, evaluates, or distributes individual patient financial or debt information until after the healthcare services have been provided. Now, importantly, this bill does not prevent the provider from sharing an individual patient's financial or medical debt information with the patient, or the patient's insurer, or the patient's third-party debt management services provider, or a third-party debt collector that the healthcare provider has contracted with, or an attorney, accountant, auditor employed by or acting on behalf of the healthcare provider, or the local, county, state, or federal government as required by law. In addition, it does not prevent the provider from disclosing a judgment that was obtained in court, and it does not prevent the provider from discussing payment options or insurance coverage with the patient. And finally, this bill only applies to medically necessary healthcare services, products, or devices, and not to cosmetic procedures without any medical necessity. In sum, this bill provides basic, common sense, and truly ground-level protections for Minnesotans. With that, I'd welcome any questions that you may have.
Okay, are there any questions from anybody? Representative Lawford, just go to the floor, I believe. Okay, the chair renews his motion to pass as amended with the A1 amendment to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Carry.
Emmer moves the minutes of March 18th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Western.
On that last bill, maybe there was no testifiers in opposition, but I didn't hear that being offered.
I thought I asked that. I wrote down that I did.
I missed it then, I guess.
Dennis is nodding yes.
Okay.
Was there anybody that was opposition? No.
I wasn't in the earlier hearing.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. I had asked that. The next two bills, Representative Davies is here, and what I'm going to explain what we're going to do on this one. My bill would have to go through Rules Committee to get there. Something got hung up in it and get introduced. So they're a little different version. Those are not supposed to be. and I'll explain it, but if we can find Representative Dabney.
Right outside.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, he was just...
That doesn't look like him.
Oh, he's over there.
Oh, there he is. So we're going to have Representative Dabney's bill up first, and then there's some of the industry that likes parts of my bill a little better, so we're going to hear that just to keep both versions for a hearing. And Representative Dabney, you are now here.
I am here.
Would somebody move Representative Dabney's bill?
I'll move it.
Representative Hilstrom moves House Bill 3612. The first engrossment, I believe.
We are apparently working off the first engrossment rather than the committee report from Commerce.
Okay. And Representative Dabney, is the A4 amendment yours?
Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment is mine. I'd ask someone to move it, and then I can speak to it briefly.
Mr. Chair?
I don't understand. We don't have... why aren't we voting on the bill that was passed out of Commerce?
I would defer to staff on that, Mr. Chair.
Do we not have any rules anymore? I mean, we did one today where we didn't even have possession of the bill. We passed an amendment without having a bill in committee, and then went to the floor.
Well, you're wrong, Representative Emmer. We did not pass an amendment without the bill.
Well, I was sitting here, and there was a vote on an amendment, so we didn't count the vote. It was a do-over.
We did it over because at the time I did not know we didn't have the bill.
And that's fair. But here we are again, Mr. Chairman. We don't have the bill that was voted out of a different committee, and what are we working on? And I know that you're trying to...
Well, Representative Emmer, on my understanding, isn't this the bill that came out of...
This is the bill that came out of committee. House File 3612.
I'm not following. And what are we missing from the Commerce Committee? Why are we? Why was there a statement that we're working off the first engrossment, and I don't know where the committee report is?
Representative Emmer, the first engrossment happens after the Commerce Committee.
My understanding.
Isn't that correct, Representative Downey, or not?
It is the right bill?
Mr. Chair?
What about amendment?
Representative Downey, my understanding is...
What about amendment?
What came out of Congress?
And the amendment, the A4 amendment, inserts the amendment from Commerce into the bill as well. So it aligns with the bill as it left Commerce.
Represents Downey. A4 amends first engrossment.
That's correct.
I don't think.
And first engrossment represents the bill as it came out of Commerce.
You can't have the same bill traveling in two different rounds in two different committees.
How can it have an A4 amendment that came out of Commerce?
Okay, well, if I misunderstand, I'm fine.
It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is the correct amendment for 3612.
This is the
right.
Put on right now.
Right. Mr. Chair, this is the right amendment for today's.
For today.
For today.
It's
yeah.
Not what came out of Commerce.
No. It is.
Again, defer to staff.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask the question, because I think Representative Dabney would be the best one to tell us what came out of Commerce. The question I'm having is if this bill, this first engrossment, went into that committee and it was amended, we should be working off the bill as it comes out of that committee amended. We shouldn't be working on... What am I missing? I'm sorry, Representative Dabney.
The bill was referred to Commerce first.
Hey.
Comes out of their chain, so then they did a first engrossment, is my understanding. Is that correct, Representative?
Its original referral was to the Commerce Committee. That's correct.
Well, then, as a first engrossment, what came out of Commerce?
I would hope.
Okay.
So to the Commerce.
So your amendment,
if like he said,
that introduced what General
Thank you.
We're all good?
I'm sorry.
It's a moment of kumbaya, Mr. Chair. Let's go out at lunch.
Just don't come and sit over here.
No, I'm not looking to either sing or hold hands, Representative Emery. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dad Nancy, Representative Emmer, has had some coffee today because I felt his wrath today on the floor a little bit.
Wow.
And I thought we were going to let me try to clarify for everyone, as I now understand you agree what I think I said about 15 minutes ago,
right,
which
back.
Is that the first endorsement is what came out of Commerce after it was amended.
Mm-hmm.
The A4 amendment is a new amendment for our committee.
Correct.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. I will move the A4 amendment to get in the shape the author wants.
That's correct.
Correct. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Here he's. Thank you. For 15 minutes, we know what we're working off of.
And Mr. Chairman, I will going to be brief. Mr. Chair and members, I will try to be brief, especially after that last interchange. So he changed sides of the room, Mr. Chair.
If I could change your party, I would.
Mr. Chair, in an effort to be brief, I will not talk about the record high foreclosure rate in Minnesota and across the nation. I will not talk about the several million households across the nation and thousands across Minnesota who are expected to default on their mortgages and lose their homes in the next few years. And I will not talk about the thousands of Minnesotans and people across the nation who now own homes that are worth less than the mortgage they have on them. I will talk briefly about the bill. It establishes a deferment period for a tightly bracketed group of borrowers in Minnesota. We estimate about 12,000 borrowers in Minnesota, 12,000 families across the state, who have lived in their home for at least 6 months, are committed to remaining in their home for the duration of the deferment period, have either a subprime or negatively amortizing loan purchased between January 1st, 2000 and August 1st, 2007, and who continue to make the stipulated mortgage payments in the bill and who apply for a deferment in order to protect their home and provide opportunities for both the borrower and the lender to work out a new mutually agreeable and mutually advantageous loan agreement and provide time for those both parties in the transaction to access tools that are being brought forward by local, county, and state governments, the federal government, the Federal Reserve, and both nonprofit and for-profit players and stakeholders in the mortgage industry. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Ron Elwood from the Minnesota Legal Services Advocacy Project to come forward.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid, and would like to say that we are in support of this bill. In addition to potentially keeping as many as 12,000 families in their homes, I think this bill has the potential to stabilize not only the families but neighborhoods, reduce the problems that have afflicted the cities in terms of crime and vandalism with abandoned homes. There was a story in the front page of the Star Tribune just the other day about pipes bursting because homes having to be destroyed because of abandonments where the gas was turned off but the water had failed to be turned off. In fact, in Champlin, I've spoken with the city manager who told me that 4 homes have been taken down as a result of this just recently. This bill has the potential to avoid those kinds of devastating effects to cities because it will keep folks in their homes. And I would also, I know our my own property value has diminished significantly when I got my recent property tax statement. And I live in a neighborhood where there are very few foreclosures. I also know that there have been reduced property values all across the state where the foreclosure values foreclosures are not very prevalent at all. So this is affecting the entire state. This bill, we believe, will go a long ways to stabilizing that devastating effect of the mortgage crisis, too. So I urge your support, and we are available for questions.
There's some opposition. We have another one.
One more brief testifier, Mr. Chair.
We allow 7 people in here.
What about fine lobbyists?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to comment. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I represent Metro Cities, and I'm also speaking on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. We do support this bill. It'll help stabilize communities. It'll help keep property values intact. We want to keep people in their homes, and that helps cities in general. So we would support this legislation and would ask for your consideration. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, are we going to hear the testimony first and leave the committee discussion?
I would like to do that, and then allow questions back and forth of the way.
Mr. Chair, members should have received a letter from both the League of Minnesota Cities and the AFL-CIO regarding their support for this bill. In addition, the Attorney General's office is in support of the bill as well.
There's opposition, I believe. Is there only one person to speak against?
Well, that would be unlikely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Pat Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Mortgage Association, and is appearing here today on their behalf. I'd like to start out by indicating that my testimony is going to be extremely short. This bill is actually what I think will now be known as a mortgage shutdown bill for the future. And here's why. Just about all of the Minnesota mortgages go into something that's called the secondary market. And that's a efficient way for the marketplace to continue to fund Minnesota mortgages. And sometimes in the past, I have said something along these lines. If you do this bill, the bill will have a negative impact on the availability for Minnesotans to secure their mortgages. And usually, that then has made for some consideration of that, because we rely on national money here in Minnesota. For the mortgage industry, it's no longer the case that Main Street banks originate and fund their own mortgages with their own investors' money. This is no longer a wonderful life. Had it been so, this money would have been provided by Minnesota entities. But that's no longer the case. It comes from both national and international sources. And if we do anything that's deleterious in Minnesota to the availability of those mortgages, we have a severe problem. Okay. So recently, within the last week, the securities market has taken note of the situation in Minnesota and has decided to author a letter. The letter is in your packet. It looks like this. And if you pull that out, I'm going to draw your attention to a couple of very disturbing sentences in that letter.
Just a second, Mr. Martin.
I don't have it.
You got my letter.
It's coming out. You can go ahead and describe it.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this sort of letter, to my knowledge and to the best representation I could find from others, has never been issued before. Not in Georgia, not in North Carolina, not in the Montgomery County debacle. Never before. This is the first time this letter has ever come forward.
Mr. Martin, I think you are assuming that everybody on this committee is on the Commerce, and I don't think... I happen to know that a couple members... I knew it before Commerce, what happened in other states. There's a couple people on here that are on Commerce that heard it there, so they now know it. But to assume that everybody knows about the fact that Georgia got cut off from mortgage funds and had to have a special session, things like that, I think you should maybe just briefly explain that before you just assume that everybody knows that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's wonderful advice, and I appreciate the guidance on that. In Georgia, that market was shut down for 6 months. Nobody in Georgia could get a loan for 6 months. And when I say nobody, I'm sure that that's not right. I'm sure that there were rarefied cases. But for the most part, the way we understand the mortgage market, that was shut down.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. So this letter, I consider very much what I call nuclear in scope. I think that it's very damaging, and the truth of the matter is that inside the letter, there are a couple of comments that I need to draw your attention to. The last sentence of the first paragraph on the first page, where it says, while well-intentioned, I'll paraphrase here, they impose substantial costs and threaten the future availability of mortgage credit to all Minnesotans, with those the legislation is intended to help being harmed the most. Again, the securities industry has never issued this way before, and I believe them when they tell us it's going to be a severe problem. On the second page, last sentence of the second paragraph, in either case, all mortgage borrowers in Minnesota will bear substantially greater costs and find fewer opportunities for affordable mortgage financing. The truth of the matter is that we're very, very alarmed that this will shut down the Minnesota mortgage market. We would hope that that's not true. But when we have a letter from the secondary market telling us that it will, that is grave news. Again, I don't believe the letter has been issued any place, in any state, at any time. Well, that's enough of my testimony creating alarm, and I'm happy to take any other suggestions you might have, Mr. Chairman, on how to improve my testimony here.
I suggest you stay around, but we have some other testifiers, but I'm sure there'll be questions. Yeah.
Thank you.
Questions after this. Yeah, we're going to take all the testifiers first,
okay.
And then that would put, because Representative Diaz-Porras had a question.
Got it. Okay.
3 seconds, and he'll answer them. Okay. Sorry. Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I'm a co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And before the legislature started and during the session, I've put in probably about 200 pro bono hours helping draft legislation and with all the committee meetings, including with Representative Dabney and with you, Mr. Chairman, prior to the session. My objective as a member of the Bar Association and co-chair of the Real Property Section Legislative Committee is to maintain...
A second, Mr. Dunleavy, I want to make sure one thing. You're not going to bill us for those billable hours,
by the way. I'd like to. I'd really like to.
You do have a nice one to say $500.
Sorry, go ahead.
I spent the whole day at the office yesterday, and it was kind of strange for me to feel like I had a whole day of billable time. But my objective is to maintain marketability of title. I want real estate to flow through commerce, because that's good for everybody. That's good for the creditors. It's good for the debtors. It's good for society. It's good for homeowners. So that's been my objective. And I've looked at this bill, and I believe that the author's amendment that we're talking about, that it's been offered today, I think, addresses most of my technical real estate concerns about marketability of title, because it does provide for prima facie evidence that the law has been complied with, and it does have a transition provision so that foreclosures that are in progress don't get start before and end after the effective date, so that you can't tell by looking at it whether or not it applies. The only technical concern I have left that way is that there's only a 7-day delay on the effective date, because I'm concerned that attorneys throughout the state aren't going to know about this, and it's going to be difficult for them to comply with the act. So other than that, my concerns are more theoretical constitutional concerns. The leading case on the constitutionality of the legislature's authority to do this type of legislation is the Blaisdell case from the 1930s, and I have a copy of it in case anyone wants to look at it. In that case, what happened in Minnesota, the legislature was reacting to the Great Depression and passed a law that said during the redemption period, the debtor could go to court and ask the court to extend the period of redemption. During the redemption period, the debtor had to make payments, and the court determined what the payments were. And a building and loan association challenged the constitutionality of that, arguing that it was an impairment of contracts. And eventually the U.S. Supreme Court decided that it was permissible under the police powers of the state. And I think part of the reason that it was permissible is because it was after the sheriff's sale, rather than before the sheriff's sale. Before the sheriff's sale, the note and the mortgage are the governing documents between the creditor and the debtor. After the sheriff's sale, it's the certificate, sheriff's certificate, which is issued under state law, and the relationship between the parties is the redemption period, which is also under state law. So I don't think there's any question that the legislature has the authority to affect the redemption period and the rights of the parties under the sheriff's certificate after the sheriff's sale. Another thing that the court looked at briefly was due process. And the due process issue is, before the state does something to you, you're supposed to have notice and an opportunity for a hearing. That's the short summary of due process. In that case, there was a judicial process. And so there was a court taking a look at it and determining whether or not, you know, there was a notice and an opportunity for a hearing. What the court looked at was, what's the value of the property? What's the reasonable rent? You know, what's the chance that the debtor is going to be able to redeem? Kind of an economic analysis. Kind of like what bankruptcy courts do now when they're looking at Chapter 13 plans. And so... the Supreme Court didn't have to think too hard about it. It passed the due process test because there was a court involvement. And the third constitutional matter that the U.S. Supreme Court looked at briefly was equal protection. And under equal protection, the legislature is supposed to have, it's not supposed to make arbitrary classifications. It's supposed to have a reasonable basis or rational basis for different classifications. And so the concern that I have about this is the loans that are of concern are the predatory loans, and I think the legislature has made a determination that negative amortization loans are also bad. Subprime loans aren't all necessarily bad. If my college age sons got a subprime loan to buy a house, I would consider that to be a good loan compared to what they spend their money on now.
So,
the problem with that is it's very difficult, I think, legislatively to define what a subprime loan is. Excuse me, what a predatory loan is. So, when I look at this bill, and then I looked at the other bill that's coming up, 4012, that one, I think, alleviates a lot of my concerns about the constitutionality because there is judicial involvement in that process.
Maybe. I believe there's at least a couple more testifiers. And Mr. Dunleavy, could you stay also close by?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is David Cantor. I'm an attorney representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. And I would like to talk about 2 points in the bill. One is the definition of a subprime mortgage. There is no universal definition of what constitutes a subprime mortgage as far as rates go. I do have a chart here which I'd like to pass around to the members of the committee, which would show you the practical effect of the index that's used in this bill to determine what constitutes a subprime loan. Now, what the index in the bill says is that it is based on the U.S. government treasury securities of equal maturity. I have used in here the 30-year index since that's the most common length of a mortgage term. You will note that from March of 2002 through January of 2006, there are NDs in the 30-year column. That's because, as the prefatory note explains, the 30-year Treasury constant maturity was discontinued during that time. What the Treasury then said was to use the 20-year index and apply an adjustment factor to that. So that adjustment factor changed daily. There was not monthly averages available, but I can tell you that it didn't vary by more than 0.2%, and it would sometimes go up and down. So those are what the 30-year and 20-year columns represent. The column labeled ARM is what, under this bill, would be the minimum rate to constitute a subprime loan. So ARM is the adjustable rate mortgages, and those were set at 2% under the bill over the 30-year index. And I've used the 20-year index roughly in those other years when the 30-year wasn't available. The fixed column represents 3 points over that index. So you can see, looking down through the columns, that the definition of subprime loan under this bill is roping in a lot of loans that are not, I don't think, in the normal layperson's idea, a subprime loan. You can look in here and see that loans in the 6% rates right now, if you have a loan in the 6% rate that was made in some of these years, that would be considered a subprime loan. And I think the reach of this bill is just too far when we start bringing in those types of loans into the subprime category. The other point I'd like to make has to do with going down the slippery slope of contract modification. At the time the lenders made these contracts, they were enforceable and in compliance with state law. And now what is happening as a result of this bill, they are being asked to defer the sale and accept reduced payments during that period of deferment. That is a material change to the contract. With the changing values in house properties right now, the lenders at the time they made the loans weren't expecting that it was going to take a year and 8 months to get their property back if they needed to sell it to recover their loss. They were expecting to get it back in 8 months. The minimum payments are typically either 65% of the current payment or the payment at the time of origination, whichever is less. And as you probably know, in the early years of a loan, most of the payment is going to interest, almost all of it's going to interest. So with the reduced payments, the lenders aren't even getting enough back to cover their carrying costs of the loan. So it's a material modification to the contract. That and along, I also support Mr. Dunleavy in the constitutional issues that he raised with respect to the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor. And there's another What's your name?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Witt. I'm president and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to chat. Mr. Cantor covered most of our technical issues that we have with the bill. I did want to get on the record the fact that we do oppose this bill and tell you a couple more technical things that we are looking at, as well as a couple of the philosophical problems that we do have with it. One of the other technical issues that we have with the bill is the effective date. I know that you want to help as quickly as possible with respect to this bill, but there are some requirements on lenders that they would have to take action very quickly under this bill, as quickly as 12 days after the effective date of the bill, with respect to taking action on some of the notices and some of the affidavits within this bill. I think that's a really quick time frame. We would do everything that we could to notify the members of the Minnesota Bankers Association, but it is possible that lenders anywhere in the country could be affected by this bill, and having major requirements on lenders 12 days after the effective date of the bill seems like it's awful fast. Another thing that I'm very troubled by is there's nothing in this bill that talks about the legal effect of the deferred payments. Under this bill, the borrower is able to make 65% of their payment, and there's no mention in this bill of what happens to the remaining 35% of their payment over the 12-month period. There's no mention as to how that should be accounted for or what the legal effect of the deferment is, and I would argue that a bill that's this important that modifies contracts in such a significant way should address what happens to the deferred payments. One other technical note, negative amortization loans are covered by this bill, and right now there are lenders who are doing reverse mortgages, which can be a good financing tool for people who own their house outright and they want to draw some of the equity that they have out of their house. I would just question, I haven't had a chance to talk to the author about that, I just had that raised by one of my members. I would question whether there shouldn't be maybe something addressed for reverse mortgages. The MBA has been working on foreclosure issues with all the working groups, all the task forces. We appreciate all the good work that's been done, and we do support, I don't know if it's 11 or 12 different bills that are going through the bodies right now that have come out of those working groups. We don't like to be in a position of having to oppose bills, but unfortunately in this case we do. The lenders have a very keen interest, as I said, in this issue. We want to work toward having good, strong, vital communities and strong neighborhoods, but in this case we do believe that this bill goes too far. Right now lenders are working as much as they can with borrowers. They're renegotiating deals. There's an alliance called the Hope Now Alliance that has worked with more than 1 million homeowners across the country to do either loan modifications or repayment plans. Those lenders and borrowers are doing it correctly in that they are looking at the individual facts and the individual circumstances of their loans to come up with a deal that's going to work for both the lender and the borrower. In this situation where the legislature just dictates the contract modification, we think that, as I said, is just going too far. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to speak on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, David Stilbred, the Vice President of...
Excited. Gathered in a little bit so we don't go over things. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, David Skibbard with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. I just want, just very briefly, I want to emphasize that we also oppose this bill. We thank Representative Dabney, Representative Mullery for the fine work last year and this year on a number of other bills, all of which we supported. We do oppose this bill, however. We have concerns about the contract provisions previously mentioned. We recognize that while we are not the target of this bill, those contract provisions we take very seriously, and as a result of that, we feel that we need to
state that we think this goes too far. Thank you for your time.
Come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In respect for time, will be extremely brief as well. My name is Matthew Lemke. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop and Weinstein. I'm here on behalf of the National Mortgage Bankers Association. And we too are opposed to this bill. And as has been pointed out, I think, earlier by Mr. Witt and others, many services already offer temporary payment deferrals for customers who have suffered a hardship and they work with these customers. A large problem with this bill, I'll just get to the crux of it, is that lenders would no longer be sure that the money they lend is truly secure or that the terms of the debt won't be altered by legislators, and I think that's probably our main point I'd like to get across on this bill. And then if I could just point out in the nuclear letter that Pat Martin alluded to that I think you all have now, on page 2, I would just read the last sentence on page 2 that says, legislative interference would have grave consequences by introducing additional unpredictability to an already fragile mortgage finance environment. For future lending, the uncertainty of the recovery on a given loan will lead lenders to charge significantly higher rates, as investors in mortgage-backed securities would expect significantly higher yields to compensate for the additional risk. And from my client's perspective, when a letter like this comes out from a group like this, we have to take heed of that. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Is there any other testifiers? Okay, then we can get the testifiers gathered round for a round of questions. Representative,
Mr. Chair, if you took all wouldn't have the opportunity, but briefly we might be able to reduce some of the questions, or at least the question and answer time.
Thank you, Mr.
Elwood.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members, just briefly to Mr. Martin's concerns. He referenced, I believe, North Carolina and Georgia, both of which were very different bills. They were predatory lending bills. North Carolina's bill had absolutely zero effect on the availability of capital in that state.
He referenced Montgomery County.
And Georgia's was dealing with Athene liability, which is not even remotely close to what we're doing here. The issue of constitutionality, I would just point out a couple of things. The Blaisdell decision, which is the leading case, 1934, the Minnesota case, the mortgage moratorium, the court noted there was a significant distinction between the obligations of the parties in contract, and again, the clause goes to the impairment of the obligations of contracts. So there's a distinct difference between those obligations of the parties and the remedy provided by the legislature to enforce those obligations. And in quoting Chief Justice Marshall, the court in Blaisdell said, without impairing the obligation, the remedy may certainly be modified by the state. The court further stated that the obligations of contract are impaired by a law which renders them invalid or extinguishes them. This bill does neither. And I could also point out that the court found that the temporary nature of the remedy provided by the Minnesota legislature in 1933 was of a temporary nature, which is this bill as well. It is found that persuasive. And finally, with regard to constitutionality, the court noted the state has the absolute right to exercise its police power to protect. But noted the state has the absolute right to exercise its police power to protect the vital interests of its people. That bill was more sweeping. It involved. It was a longer extension period and involved investor property, which this bill doesn't. Similarly, the Farm Lender Mediation Act, which the Minnesota Court of Appeals upheld in 1986, again another Minnesota case, found that the change in remedy of a contract, enforcement of a contract, is valid. Mr. Cantor talked about the definition of subprime. I want to point out that our definition, what we're using here, is consistent with what the federal government now is using in many of these bills proposed, and that's what this bill is all about, is to provide some ability to the federal government to provide relief for us. And in terms of the expectations of the lenders, I would point out that I don't think they expected homes that no longer exist because they've been destroyed, or that will lay fallow in a market where they can't sell the property and the value of the home is now less than the amount owed on the mortgage. With respect to Mr. Witt's comments, I would point out that with respect to the legal effect, the amendment on page 2, lines 20 to 27 should address that issue completely. And I'd also point out that Mr. Witt's members are exempt from this bill. And so that's that. And finally, with respect to Mr. Lemke's comments, I would point out that this has zero effect on future loans. It only affects loans made prior to August 1st, 2007.
I think actually it's called through rebuttal, so I'll give you under the court rules that, by the way, the Supreme Court actually amazingly saw the brilliance of a certain representative from North Minneapolis a few years ago, and the legislature passed the law one way and then they passed the law a different way, and the Supreme Court said, nah, those don't make any sense. We're going to take this other idea. That's now the court rule, but... it's the only one in the country, by the way, that does it this way. I'm sorry, Mr. Wick, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate the chance to make another couple of statements here. The Blaisdell case, I think, actually, and I appreciate Mr. Elwood pointing this out to the committee. The Blaisdell case did draw a sharp distinction between changing the obligations of the parties and simply changing the remedies. I just remind this committee that this, and I agree with that take on the case that Mr. Elwood said, but this one does both. It does both change the obligations of the party and change the remedies. In the farmer lender mediation challenge, the court held in favor of the bill largely because it was seen as a temporary remedy. That was one of the most important factors of that case. And as you know from being around here for a while, the farmer lender mediation remedy that was put in place because of the extreme conditions of the farm crisis in the 1980s is still on our books right now today. And I think that because the temporary nature of that particular law was so pivotal to the court, I'm guessing they may have decided differently if they knew that it was going to be in place forever, which frankly gives us, you know, some of our pause here that remedies, once they're on the books, tend to last forever. And as to whether or not this bill affects my members, there are the amendment that was put into place for banks deals with loans that are originated by banks, and some of our members do purchase loans that were originated by other than banks. So we're still trying to get our arms around exactly how many loans that is, but I know of several of our members that would still be significantly affected by that, even with the amendment that Mr. Elwood referenced. Thank you.
I think I'm going to finally be able to get some members, but I think maybe then, rather than listing the ones that want questions, I think it would be easier to ask who doesn't want to be on the list. Okay. Not on the committee. We've got seven right now. De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I guess what I'll do in the interest of time is just make three comments that I hope my colleagues will keep in mind when considering this bill. First of all, I can't help but note the League of Minnesota City support and just wonder hypothetically what their position would be if instead we were entertaining a bill to allow homeowners to just pay 65% of their property taxes to their city. I think the tune might be a bit different. Second, members, it's nice to have a law school type discussion about Blaisdell and what Brandeis might have meant 75 years ago, et cetera. But look, what we're doing here is a simple thing. By legislative fiat, we are defeating the contractual expectations of one party to a contract. And what that's going to mean is that the message is going to be sent to the investors whose money makes the Minnesota mortgage market work, is that there is a risk that their contract may not be enforced in Minnesota. We said we've got existing loans, we have existing expectations, contractual out there. And what it further means is that in the secondary market, when they do these complex collateralized debt obligations and the like that also make the market work,
people are, there's going to be investors who are unwilling in secondary markets to invest in Minnesota mortgages. That's what it's going to mean. And that's why I fear, I don't know if I share the nuclear letters sort of Armageddon-like view that we may not get mortgages in Minnesota, but I can tell you they'll be more expensive because the risk premium will be built in and they'll be far more expensive. Third, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence. Nobody has yet, even in Commerce Committee here today, talked about Section 8, which imposes upon a foreclosing lender possibly actual damages, statutory damages, punitive damages, costs, and attorney's fees. It seems just a bit heavy-handed to me, especially in light that there appears to be no remedy in the bill if, for example, an eligible homeowner lies on their affidavit, for example. So I think that the proportion is lacking there. And for those reasons, that I will be opposing the bill.
Senator Dale, of course, I thought I saw that there was a penalty for a false affidavit. Isn't there, Mr. Elwood, is there no... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting a few of these foreclosure bills a little confused. There's
the
only about 20 this year.
Next
one is... You're finished, Dale?
Yes, thank you.
Rivers and Bigham, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's more of a comment, and it was it kind of stemmed from the testifier on the CIFMA. You know, you worry about how this is going to affect, you know, the future ability for mortgages to be resold and stuff like that. And, you know, if somebody's been a victim of predator lending, their house is now foreclosed, and they're going to be homeless and their credit is ruined, they're not going to be able to get another mortgage. And I just think that some of your comments were a little bit unfounded in the letter. And I just think that, Representative Dabney, I like your bill. And I think it's a start, and we have to do something for this issue. And I believe this is good, and I'll be supporting it. I'll pass.
Wow. Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dabney, I think I told you once, and Mr. Elwood, that I was gonna support this, and I like the idea. But after hearing some of these people come up and testify, I have some concerns. You know, I'm thinking of all, you know, I look at this letter, which looks pretty damaging, and I'm thinking to myself as I read this, you know, what if say that the CEO, after we put this through, of U.S. Bank, he can't upgrade to a Gulfstream 5 next year. He has to stay with the Gulfstream 4, which doesn't even have a flat screen TV, as I understand. Or and the CEO of Wells Fargo, you know, he can't provide the Dancing Bears for his wife's $2 million birthday party or something. I mean, that's really going to dance. That's going to dance the future. And And I go through here, and I look at this, and I see all the people in suits coming up to testify how horrible this is going to be. Follow the money, members. We all know where the money's going. Every time an industry comes up here and says it's going to damage the consumer, why are the consumers in here testifying? It's always the industry coming in here testifying saying this is going to be bad for the people in Minnesota. But they're the ones making the money. All the money, I think this is obviously, I was being facetious earlier, Representative Dabney, but there's no question. You know, some people may see this as, you know, a nuclear option, so it's going to have to be followed up from the American Securitization Forum or Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association as being horrible for the state of Minnesota. So worst case scenario, Minnesotans have contracts for deeds and they rely on each other. And the banks lose their clout and authority over everyone. The people in my neighborhoods are being kicked out of their homes. And until the people in their gated communities who run banks are approached by people with pitchforks and torches, nothing's going to happen. And short of that, I think it's a good option for Senator Dabney.
Representative Emmerich, next.
I got to overcome that last, the pitchforks. I'm scared. Mr. Chair, I actually have a question. And the question is, I don't know that I heard in Representative Dabney, somebody, what happened to that 35%? Where did it go?
The
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I've got at least two answers for you. Number one, in the amendment, it includes, let's see if I can find it, page 2, lines 11 through 13. By the end of the deferment, this is on the notice to the borrower, by the end of the deferment period, you will need to pay the entire amount that has been deferred plus other costs allowed by law in order to avoid a foreclosure sale. So the borrower is noticed up front that they may need to pay that 35% at the end of the deferment period. The intent of this bill is to buy both parties time. Time to access the tools that are being brought forward by, again, local, county, state, and federal government entities, nonprofit, and for-profit sector to try to provide opportunities to work out and rework mortgages. The Treasury Secretary, Secretary Snow, has expressed significant frustration that lenders are not doing those workouts. And we're seeing that in Minnesota, we're seeing it across the country, where lenders, in fact, are interfering with the opportunity of borrowers to even refinance, let alone work out a new loan with a different interest rate, reducing the principal, as Fed Chairman Bernanke has called for lenders to do. This provides folks time, and maybe most importantly, provides opportunity for a new president and a new Congress to come into office on the federal level and take another whack at this issue beginning in January of 2009.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that, Representative Dabney. I just think the language that you put in here is different from the situation. I told Mr. Elwood earlier today that I didn't go back and read the Blaisdell case. But just briefly looking at the Constitution in Article 1, Section 10, I think it is, I think your bill does violate the Constitution. Even if it doesn't, even if you are right, you are going to, I think, if this becomes law, put the state of Minnesota in a position of long and protracted legal issues, litigation, not only from people within Minnesota, from entities within Minnesota, but more importantly, from entities outside of Minnesota. And I know folks are irritated by this letter, and I appreciate Representative Lesch's viewpoint, but I think that the folks in this community who are suffering, what we're doing here is we're potentially, we're not just hurting them once, we're hurting them again. Because it is a stack of cards. Unfortunately, everybody bears some responsibility for it. I don't think there's any question about that. But this answer, it goes right at the fundamental issue of not only contracts, but credibility of those obligations. And I think the second you start to put into question whether they're credible obligations, the ripple effect is going to be dramatic. And I don't know that that's been completely thought through. It looks like people are now suddenly taking it serious and running up and giving you information as you're going, because I think we had a hearing not long ago in North Minneapolis, and I didn't see a lot of the information that we're now getting. I just think that in the effort to try and help folks, this ultimately is going to hurt them a lot worse than they're being hurt right now. It's going to hurt all of us. And I don't think it's just a matter of the gated communities and flat-screen TVs for CEOs who support the Democrat Party. I think it's a lot bigger than that. I'm trying to add some levity. I apologize. A sense of humor is misplaced.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, a sense of humor is always appreciated. Mr. Martin is a gentleman I've had the opportunity to work with quite a bit and respect, and expect to be able to work with him again in the future. I would like to remind members of who the actual authors of this letter are. They're representatives of an industry filled with highly paid individuals with impressive degrees from well-respected and elite colleges and universities who work in fancy offices in tall office buildings in some of the most expensive zip codes in the country. And Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, those people got it wrong.
Monday's Wall Street Journal. So far, banks and insurers have written down more than $150 billion, with a B, in securities tied to subprime mortgage loans. Those markdowns include both residential mortgage securities and debt pools, as Representative De La Forest referenced, known as collateralized debt obligations that are underpinned by mortgage securities. Losses like these could total $285 billion, Standard & Poor's estimated on Thursday. These people are the ones who brought the American economy to its knees and the real estate market flat on its face. And when they say in their letter that pension and mutual funds are large buyers of AAA mortgage-backed securities, and any reduction in the value of these securities will be reflected in the value of those pension and mutual funds, where do you think that $285 billion is disappearing from? It's not from House File 3612. It's from the incompetent, greedy members of these organizations. They've done the damage already to this country, and I would encourage members to evaluate the messenger as they evaluate the message.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. I do appreciate that, Representative Dabney. I'd prefer, and maybe we come from completely different perspectives. I think we do a lot of the time. But, rather than the class warfare attack, I think I would look at it from the viewpoint that we all are in this together. There is greed on both sides of this ledger. I think it's somewhat unfair to focus on offices that I've never seen and people that I don't know. I'm just a little guy in Minnesota that reads this and has to ask the question, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, can you guarantee me, can you give me some assurance that we pass your bill so that all of a sudden our residents, our citizens, suddenly do not have mortgage money available to buy their first home? Can you give me assurances that this stack of cards, because of this type of legislation, suddenly won't bring it all down so that the American dream is not available anymore to anyone here in Minnesota unless you have a bucket load of cash that you can put out for it? Can you give me that assurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I wish you'd met Mr. Williams. He's a constituent of mine. He's got learning disabilities in fourth grade reading level. He's taking care of his terminally ill 80-year-old uncle. When he got his first computer with internet access, he answered a survey that popped up in a pop-up window. Within 5 minutes, he was getting calls from mortgage lenders offering him a new mortgage. He needed windows, so he took one of them up on the deal. Turned out, even though they told him it was one mortgage and a fixed rate, it was two mortgages and an adjustable rate. He's continued to work, he's continued to pay on that mortgage, and as of April 1st, he would be out of his home. That wasn't greed on the part of Mr. Williams to upgrade his home to more energy-efficient windows. That was predatory lending. When we had the hearing on this bill in Commerce, Representative Mahoney, who chairs the Bioscience Committee, shared that he's had venture capitalists up in front of his committee the last 2 years talking about investment in Minnesota. And what they have said each step of the way is if there's money to be made, we'll be here to invest. My observation of business is if there's money to be made, somebody will be there.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Representative Dabney, whether you believe this or not, I have unbelievable respect for your passion when it comes to things like this. But I want to tell you, I think you're being incredibly unfair to me if you suggest that the people you represent are the only ones that are suffering right now. If you take a look at the number of foreclosures that have been instituted in Wright County, you'll see that it's not just your constituents, it's all of our constituents that are suffering right now. And what I'm asking you for, and it's difficult because it's such an emotional issue, what I'm asking you for is the assurance that you go doing this, it's not just the money that's available for our private mortgage market, but what are the folks that are doing commercial lending? What are the folks that are taking care of doing the lending for our schools, for our state? What suddenly is going to be the reaction, whether you like these people or not, but those folks that control these financial markets, what assurance can you give me that if this doesn't have this ripple effect and cost all of us in Minnesota a lot more, and the folks that are truly suffering, I'm asking for that kind of assurance, if you can give it to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I would remind you of two things. One, this bill is, as written, only affects loans that are no longer being made. So there should be no concern by the lending or securitization communities, if those are communities, industries, about forward-moving lending practices. And secondly, it does not affect investor-owned properties. This is only for owner-occupied residential properties.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I'm done. I just want to point out that, okay, great. So it only applies this time, but all those people look at trends and they look at experience in different locations. Once they see us do this, why wouldn't they expect us to do it in the future? And that's why Representative De La Forest says, believe me, they'll build in the risk factor. So, I do appreciate the passion, and I appreciate that you're trying to do something. I just have some grave concerns about the ripple effect that it could have on a lot of other areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Emmer, again, I can't see the clock so clearly, but you're right that it isn't just Representative Dabney's district or Representative Mullery's district where we were a couple weeks ago. My county, Chicago County, at the edge, like your county, Representative Emmer, my county has the highest rate of foreclosures per capita in the state. I think it's only getting worse. And I'm having a little bit of deja vu for two reasons. One is I feel like I was here a year ago having the same kind of conversation about the renewable energy standard in the Energy Committee, where utility after utility after utility came forward and said, we can't do this, you'll kill the industry. We can't do this, it'll cost too much. We don't need to do this. And what's happening? Representative Dabney, you said it right. They've adjusted. They're working on making money. They're working on, we have an accelerating market, not as fast as you and I would like on the green job side, but business has adjusted and adjusted quite well, thank you very much. And we have not seen the dire predictions actually come to light. In fact, I think we're seeing the impact that we all hoped would happen starting to happen pretty significantly. And I think that that our industry partners here need to take that message to light and start working with us, because their livelihoods are as at stake as every one of the families in my district that's facing foreclosure. The second reason I'm having deja vu is I've lived this. My family lost our third generation store down in Sioux City, Iowa, during the farm crisis because our neighbors were being foreclosed. The economy just collapsed. Three quarters of downtown Sioux City, where we moved after when I was 1 year old, boarded up in the mid to late 80s because of some bad decisions and because of the consolidation and because families are being left behind. The entire economy suffers as we're seeing numbers because of the foreclosure crisis. If it's a question of siding on the side of families and small businesses and others, or the writers of this letter and others, I think that we should be leaning towards the small business owners and the families and the Main Street folks that are really bearing the brunt of it. And I know that the folks that disagree with you and I, Representative Dabney, have their concerns. I don't see them playing out. I see that this bill is the right step, and I want to just thank you for the long, hard hours slogging through the very dry discussions about 70-year-old case law to put this bill together, and I certainly wish that folks are standing up for us
during the farm crisis and the foreclosure crisis hitting our farmers in the early 80s, and it would have made a huge, huge difference in my life.
Mr. Chair, members, I just got to let the badger out here just for a second.
They go
the claws come out.
Are you
going to
be the one that gives us a true explanation
yes.
of the place out there?
I'll clear it all up for you. I'm an expert on everything. Representative Zavny, I think you villainized the banking industry here. I mean, that was ridiculous, some of the statements you made. I hope I never see a poor banker, and I hope I never see a bank office in the bottom of the dollar store. If I start seeing bankers with blue jeans on and driving around old Fiat, that worries me. I have nothing. What do you got against free enterprise or capitalism or America? So what if CEOs are rich? I mean, you villainize the banking industry, but yet you protect the casinos who are ka-ching, taking more advantage of the elderly and the old and the victims than anybody. You protect the casinos, but villainize the banking industry. I mean, we should be fair. These folks, when I started out, 9 kids on a farm, my dad was dirt poor. He got help year after year after year by the banks, and I still do. And to villainize these people for making money, big deal. If they didn't make money, they wouldn't be able to give loans. So I think he's grandstanding a little bit here.
Mr. Chair, President Cornish, if it's the comments that I made that I think you're speaking to, it was not the banking industry I was speaking of.
And everybody isn't a predatory lender. There's a lot of the lenders that are great. You categorize them all and made it look like this is a predatory lending bill. This isn't. I mean, we should be adding on everybody with a big medical bill onto this bill or somebody that can't pay their bills. If we want to do it right, break the bank, let's pay them off, and put everybody in one big bunch that's behind on their bills and not hurt the bankers and expect somebody that's entered into a legal contract and take to the sides of another. Let's just break the bank somewhere and pay everybody's bills. It's made
okay.
Bad decisions.
We're at a point of getting far beyond the scope of anything that's what to do whatsoever with this bill. Unless there's an enormous objection, I'm going to call for a vote on this bill. So all in favor, and I can't even remember so long ago, Representative Zavny, do you have any idea who moved your bill?
I believe you did, Mr. Chair, and I believe it was for the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I sent a note. I thought we should be adjourned because it's 5 p.m. was the time that we're supposed to go on Easter break. Per the memo from the speaker, we're done at 5 p.m. I don't understand why we're voting on anything.
Well,
we didn't get any subsequent memo. I mean, I've seen an email.
Representative Immer, we're going to continue, and if you want to challenge the actions on that basis, then you can do so. All in favor of the chair's amendment to pass the bill as amended to the general register, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
No. Carries.
Mr. Chair, members.
Are we done?
Now we should be done, shouldn't we? I'm going to
ask. Chair Mulder, would you like to move House File 4012?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move 4012, and then I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, do we have possession of this bill?
Yes, Representative Emmer, we do. It's sitting on the floor today.
I was just asking.
Chair Mulder.
All right, thank you.
The A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment.
Yes, I have all of them.
We have to vote on that part.
To get the bill in the shape you'd like it. All those in, actually, let's wait for the A1 just to be distributed real quick. So, if you want to go ahead and take to your bill.
Okay, the purpose of this bill is to, it's a lot like Representative Dabney's bill, but it I think meets challenges better to the legality of what's being done, and I think it's also more fair to get at what we're really trying to get at. The Dabney bill resulted from a conversation between Curtis Cox and I, where he had a good idea of a narrow moratorium on the subprime lending, and I thought that we needed to require payments in the meantime. So I that part came from me, and then I also thought that we should tie it into allowing time for a new Congress and a new president to pass the Dodd bill, which the present president has said he would not allow to go into law on bankruptcy regarding changing the clawback provision, which now apply to both business and to second homes, but don't apply to homeowners. And the Dodd bill would apply to homeowners. And it's also, at the time I was discussing this, it was before the head of the Federal Reserve came out and spoke in favor of requiring lenders to use good faith requirements, much like HUD does on theirs. And the bill I have is much like one that I talked to the head of J.P. Morgan Chase when I was out speaking on foreclosures, what states could do it, and the Boston Federal Reserve symposium last fall. And that head of the mortgage department thought that the type of thing I was talking about here would be okay. I'm also very concerned because I do carry a lot of bills for the low-income consortium, the ones that talk about getting home loans for low-income people, and there is an actual concern about what we do having an effect on the points and things like that in the future. So the difference in my bill is two things. And one is that it has a provision in it for good faith negotiations. And the point of this is that most of the bad things that are happening came from unregulated lenders. HUD has now instituted mitigation requirements of good faith negotiations whereby it's much like you have to look at the present, for instance, income, the value of the house, etc., and write terms, offer terms that would be appropriate for that in order to apply to HUD. This would be requiring, if the bank can prove that they have provided and offered good faith negotiations, both with regard to HUD type requirements and also with regard to the what we would expect to be the cram down provisions, if using the present ones in the bankruptcy to apply to this. So banks would be allowed that, and they could go to court. And I think this also meets the requirement that the Bar Association brought up as far as a problem under Blaisdell with the other law, in that there's no provision for a court to set something or to appeal to a court. That's the one change, and the other change is in, if now we'll take the A1 amendment.
Members, the A1 amendment has been passed out, and it is an author's amendment given the shape you would like it. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment that the chairman already has moved, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment to
Mr. Chair and members, the purpose of this amendment is to not give the borrower or whoever has the borrower's interest an extremely long period of time, which I don't think was not my intent when I discussed the bill originally when we were talking about putting it together with Prentice Cox. Under the Dabney bill, it normally takes about 4 to 5 months from the time of the default until the sale. Then you get a 6-month redemption period. So under the Dabney bill, if you go 5 months, and then you file that on the day of sale, and then you get another year, roughly, you're up to 17 months then, and then you get another... Then, at that point, under the Dabney bill, you start over for the 10 to 11 month normal foreclosure period. So you're now talking about 28 months of time period. And I'm not sure that that isn't going quite a bit further than we really want to go on getting fairness for the borrowers. What this would do would it would give them that 5 months or whatever, they get the sale, then they get the year, so they're up to about 17 months. Then after that, they would get about, it could be done in about, I think it's 3 months I had in here, I can't remember exactly, and that can be worked out as we go along, but so... They would be getting, rather than almost 2.5 years, they'd get a little under 2 years. So it's if we're really trying to get the people a chance to work it out and yet trying to at least be perceived as being fair to the lender's interest, I think that this meets the requirements better. So I think this one would unquestionably, in my mind, be upheld by any court. And I think the other one has, as the Bar Association mentioned, has some problems. So thank you, Chair Mulry. Questions from members? Anyone that you would like to testify on your bill, Chair Mulry?
No, I don't have
any. Seeing no questions, Representative Emmer.
I just want to re-register my complaint. I think we're past the 5 o'clock. I think this is untimely, and we shouldn't be doing this. This is a blatant violation of rules. That's all.
Duly noted, Representative Emmer.
Chair, I don't think it's proper to re-register.
I'll restate it if Representative Lesch would prefer.
I'd accept that.
duly noted, the left hand and the far left hand over there. Chair Mulry renews his motion that House File 4012, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails.
Oh.
And I believe our meeting...
I'm sorry.
Representative Simon, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Before we adjourn, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if Chair Mulder could tell us, are we going to be having any post-deadline hearings, informational hearings, other things?
Representative Simon. Chair Mulder.
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. I'm guessing I've been asked about some informational hearing by members, and I think we may be doing that.
Mr. Chair, despite over my objections, we continue on. I'm just wondering, are we going to hear Representative Smith's immigration bill? I thought we were going to do that at some point. As long as here we are, we're after the time. Are we going to be doing that?
Representative Emmer, I have no idea what you are talking about. I have never seen an immigration bill, and I didn't know there was one even in my committee.
My understanding,
Representative Emmer, I've not heard anything. I've never said we were going to hear one, and I don't know anything about what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair,
Smith had an immigration.
Well, my understanding was that a member of the committee, in fact, your assistant chair, had indicated that we'd have an opportunity to present the immigration bill.
Representative Emmer, I expressed interest as an individual member in knowing more about the bill and signed on to the bill, and that's the extent of the actually, Mr. Bearden and I had a conversation. I said that we were meeting the next day, and that I would check on the bill, and that's about the extent of the conversation. So,
Well, Mr. Chair, are we not going to honor that then? I mean, is that... This is what I tried to get on the record a week ago, that we were going to do this. It was our... We were led to believe we were going to get a chance to present an immigration bill, and now we're being told that...
Representative Hemmer...
Chair Morris.
I don't know how things work when you were in the majority, but members of the committee don't normally schedule bills or decide what's going to be on the agenda.
Mr. Chair, when last time I checked, the member that we're talking about was the assistant chair of the committee.
Representative Emmer, I just want to correct you again that there was, pledge to hear a bill. There was interest expressed about the bill, and I said I would check on it, and I honored that commitment, and I honored the commitment to sign on the bill. So, Chair Mullery. I was just about to do so. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned.